Actual speeds may vary.
7-Up is now 100% natural. It's crisper, cleaner, and better tasting than ever, because it's been stripped of the artificial stuff found in most soft drinks. It's a big change, to be sure. And naturally, some of you have questions.
Where should I look for 7-Up now?
Same place as always, right next to the other lemon-lime sodas. You know, the less tasty ones with the phony ingredients.
So what did they do with the artificial ingredients after they stripped them out of 7-Up?
We threw them in a dumpster out back. I'm sure the raccoons have found them by now.
I have a two-part question. One, is drinking 100% natural 7-Up like experiencing lemon lime in high def? And two, will it give me the sensation of cartwheeling naked through a citrus orchard?
One, yes. And two, just how would you know what that feels like?
I've heard. Never mind.
7-Up. There's no question it's crisper, cleaner, and better tasting than ever, because it's now 100% natural.
Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and welcome to the broadcast. Another Sunday night in Detroit, broadcasting to southeastern Michigan, southern Ontario, northern Ohio, on the air on 101.1, and then, of course, by the Internet all across the country, all across the world. Some of you listening as far away as Asia, northern Europe, Mexico, welcome to you all. Remember that number. Some of you in other countries have figured out fairly cheap ways, or I don't even know if it's so difficult anymore, to call into 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. It's a phone-in talk show. Increasingly, I mean, I always think it's just us, the ones that have been listening and doing this and talking for at least a few years, but then I increasingly get email from people say, I just heard you for the first time, or I just saw your web address on the Internet and tuned in and all that. Well, welcome to everybody. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com is our email address, and that will maybe get you on the air and read a short message, but try to keep them short. This hour of Night Call brought to you by Waking Up. It's Metro Detroit's sweatshop free clothing store located in the Universal Mall, 12 Mile and DeQuinder in Warren. You can go online at wakingupstore.com. Remember, they are sponsoring the Waking Up Green Expo. That's going to be Saturday, September 16th at the Universal Mall. I will be speaking. What a week, huh? Terrorist plot. Allegedly, I'll tell you about the allegedly in just a second. Israel's continuing war of destruction in Lebanon, even though we head down to the final 2 hours of it. Fighting is raging. Israel is bombing Beirut. And also the defeat of Democrat Joe Lieberman by Democrat Ned Lamont, all the fallout from that. My personal website, a lot of what I say, you can find longer articles about at my website, peterwerby.com, PETERWERBE.com. I'm not selling anything, and well, you get some way. If you go to people's websites, they drop, like, is it a cookie or something like that on your, in your, I don't know, but I don't do anything. So it's just there for your edification or enjoyment. Well, in the last minutes of the final hours of Israel's war to destroy Hezbollah, which hasn't done that in the slightest, apparently. It's really just destroyed the civilian infrastructure of the, Israel always says the only democracy in the Middle East, which isn't true at all. They have one right next door. It is called Lebanon, or maybe we should even put that in the past tense, because who knows? Now Hezbollah is probably the strongest element in the in the country, and let's see, a lot of rockets falling here. Just Israel's cabinet became the final party to sign under the UN ceasefire Sunday. It's supposed to happen at 1 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. That's our time here, 8 a.m. There. And this war, which I don't know that either side expected that. Certainly Hezbollah didn't when it invaded this disputed territory of Sheba Farms and killed some Israeli soldiers, what was it, three, and captured two others. no one could have expected. Well, I don't know. Certainly Hezbollah did not expect this response that virtually has destroyed Lebanon. And I don't think Israel expected that they would get the sort of response, the ferocious response that has done little, some, maybe even considerable, to diminish the military strength of Hezbollah. Israel launched an air and ground offensive, it says here in this account. 4.5 weeks of combat. Combat have killed at least 782 people in Lebanon, mostly civilians. People are characterizing, it's the civilization, our Western white civilization, against the armed, irrational, religious fanatics of the East, the other, the ultimate other, with a capital O. Except here, what they say that killed at least 782 people in Lebanon. I'm sure you'll have to add another 1,000 onto that. They're still digging the kids out of the rubble. So those have been killed in Lebanon, mostly civilians, and 152 Israelis, including 113 soldiers. So I can't do, let me see if it was. They've killed 40 Israeli civilians and 140. I don't know. You get it, but how can you know when I'm thinking about six things. So sorry, I can't even do simple math right here. But Israel has overwhelmingly killed civilians, and Hezbollah, these people who have no soul, no conscience, want only death and destruction, have killed mostly soldiers. Now, one of the things I've gotten from some of you people who just have no questions whatsoever about what Israel does is say, well, Israel doesn't target civilians. Hezbollah is targeting civilians. Well, I guess when your kids get killed, you really don't care too much about intent, do you? And I would say that they are not targeting civilians. Israel is not. They just don't care. Because if they think this is a possible Hezbollah site, whether it's a gas station or an ambulance with a Red Cross on top, what the hell? Kill them all, let Yahweh sort them out, right? Among the dead soldiers this weekend was Staff Sergeant Yuri Grossman, the 20-year-old son of renowned Israeli novelist and peace activist David Grossman, killed by an anti-tank missile. Let's see. Israel will stop trying to win captured soldiers. We almost have forgotten about that, but would not accept a link between their freedom and Hezbollah's demand that Israel free Lebanese prisoners. So they have, two or three are being held by Hezbollah, and I can't remember how many hundreds. Essentially, Hezbollah wanted the women and children that Israel holds to be freed. Israel says the British Broadcasting Company is not reporting fairly. The Foreign Ministry of Israel, this is from the Jerusalem Post, is under pressure from Israeli citizens to resume its boycott of the BBC and to withdraw credentials from its reporters due to what they call one-sided reports on the war in Lebanon, Israeli diplomatic officials said on Wednesday. Which means, in fact, in here it says, let's see, the only English language where I thought that was interesting. They said it was the, oh yeah, here, Colonel Mira Eisen, who is said to take over as Prime Minister's Ehud Olmert's spokeswoman on August 20th, called the BBC, quote, the only international English-speaking news outlet that is downright hostile to Israel on every level. Well, I think if you look, go to BBC, is it just BBC.com or something like that? Or if you just Google BBC, take a look at their reporting. Tell me if you think it's one-sided. What they want is what has appeared, although not quite as much as they'd like here either. Initially it was. But it's kind of hard to see the destruction of a country that is absolutely unable to stop the kind of bombing that's taken place from U.S.-supplied planes at Israel and bombs and not have some sympathy for the hundreds and hundreds of civilians that have died and the hundreds of thousands of people that have been displaced. So the fact that the BBC doesn't put itself as a propagandist for Israel means that they're not reporting the war fairly, the way like Fox News or something like that does. 313-298-WRIF. Well, what's it all about? What's it all about? Here's what I think it's all about. I picked up the New York Times on August 11th. what is, where are we, the 13th? So is that Friday? And, or maybe it was a little, I'm lost on math. I'm lost on dates here. It's the 13th, right? So this was Friday. So here are the two pieces sitting next to each other. What's all there? First one, terror plot foiled. Airports quickly clamp down. And it begins to tell the story that British authorities said Thursday that they had dwarfed. It's an interesting slip of the tongue, Pete, that they had thwarted an advanced terrorist plot to blow up airplanes flying from Britain to the United States using liquid explosives. Now, we all pretty much aware that that's going on. But that's a terror plot foiled. Airports quickly clamped down. My first thought was, I was painting my house, and I had the news on through the window, and I thought, this is BS, like most of their terror plots. I mean, the only one that was real, the 911, in this country at least, of course, there's been other ones in Spain and in Britain, and you can understand why they're doing a lot of police work, why they are anxious to stop anything like happened with the bus and train bombings. I mean, that's, and you would think that in this country we would be as vigilant, but of course we find out funds are being cut and all that. Anyway, so terror plot foiled, airports quickly clamped down. But the first thought I had is, can I believe this? Can we actually trust Bushko to really tell us the truth? Tony Blair, both the guys who lied about Iraq. But, okay, let's give it to them. I mean, they seem to have some substantial evidence, but I would wait. See, that's what I always say about critical thinking. Wait. In fact, remember what I've said. I think the best way to do it is assume they're lying. And then wait till the evidence comes in, because we don't want to get fooled again. We get fooled over and over and over again. We get fooled because we're frightened. We get fooled because we have trust in these people. And, yeah, we get frightened the terrorists win, right? All right, so let me, without all these asides, which I am famous for. So, it says, terror plot foiled, airports quickly clamped down. Big headline on the New York Times, right next to it, but in smaller headline type, just one column. Israel asks U.S. to ship rockets with wide blast. The hell does that mean? So, whole front page is about terror plot. But then over on the side, it says Israel has asked the Bush administration to speed delivery of short-range anti-personnel rockets armed with cluster munitions. So they're cluster bombs, which could use to strike Hezbollah missile sites in Lebanon. The request for M-26 artillery rockets, which are fired in barrages and carry hundreds of grenade-like bomblets that scatter and explode over a broad area, is likely to be approved shortly, along with other arms, a senior U.S. official said. But some State Department officials have sought to delay the approval because of concerns over the likelihood of civilian casualties and the diplomatic repercussions. Now, aren't cluster bombs banned? These are anti-personnel weapons that just destroy human beings, that shred them. The rockets, which, while they would be very effective against hidden missile launchers, officials say, are fired by the dozen and could be expected to cause civilian casualties of use if used against targets in populated areas. And that's where they are, right? But Israel doesn't care. It's not targeting civilians. But if you happen to chew another 100 or so, what the hell? And the United States, who's the paymaster of Israel, with our tax dollars, that's giving them all the weapons by which they are destroying Israel, because two or three of their soldiers were Lebanon. There's destruction in Israel as well, as we've seen. But remember, Hezbollah didn't start sending those rockets until Israel began destroying Lebanon. I mean, it's really a case like school kids, except that this is serious stuff. He started it. In the meantime, mountains of dead of civilians. I say damn them both. But when you see this, Israel asks U.S. to ship rockets with cluster bomb capacity, you begin to look and start to see some of the reasons that we're enmeshed in these internecine slaughters and what role we actually play in helping to pile up the corpses of civilians, both there and in Iraq. And when you hear Bush, the genius, hate our freedom, I mean, can't they give him another line? Now, why are they doing this? Why is Hezbollah doing what it's doing? Because they hate our freedom? Oh, I guess this was the plotters. That's right. That was the plotters, liquid bomb plotters. They hate our freedom. Well, do you think that there might be a little aspect that is not our freedom they hate? Although these guys are right-wing theocrats, just like George Bush. It's the right-wing fighting. Olmert, the prime minister of Israel, a religious state. So we have all these, we have religious Christian fanatics running our government. You have these religious Jewish fanatics with a grasp on Israel, and you have these Muslim fanatics in Lebanon. And they've got us, the American citizens, directly involved in all this madness. Shouldn't we just get the hell out of the Middle East, period? That's what's pissing these people off. I'm not trying to say they would never try to do anything again, but if we stop supplying Israel, if we stop the occupation of Iraq, if we stop the occupation of Saudi Arabia, if we stopped trying to extract all their oil and control it, I'll bet you we would calm about 95% of the hatred. And you reduce it by 95% and you just have the pure nuts. Well, they don't have any popular base and no popular support. Do you think when people cheer in the Middle East when things happen to us, it's because they hate our freedom? Or do you think they see what's going on in Lebanon and Palestine, which is also being obliterated by Israel, Gaza? Do you think that they hate our freedom, or do you think that because there's American troops in Saudi Arabia? Do you think they hate our freedom, or do you think it's because we have troops from Michigan and Texas and Ohio and Arkansas right now, 13,000 American troops going through Baghdad, breaking down doors and taking people off blindfolded? Don't you think that might be a little better idea of why they hate us? I would think so. That's for sure. Well, it gets worse. This little article here. U.S. wonders if all plotters were caught, according to Chertoff. Chertoff is Michael Chertoff, the Homeland Security Secretary, doing a heck of a job, too. American officials remain concerned that some people connected with a plot to blow up planes may have eluded arrest, according to Michael Chertoff. Of course, they want us to be afraid. This is the fear card that the Republicans are playing. They're down the absolute tubes. Bush has a popularity rating of about 33%. Over 60% of Americans think the war in Iraq is getting worse and it's a mistake. So what do they have left? Just to scare the stuff out of us, right? That's what they're going to do. That's what they're banking on. We haven't fully analyzed the evidence, so we're concerned there are some plotters out there, Mr. Chertoff said on This Week. We're also concerned about other groups who may carry out attacks because they think we're distracted. What are we distracted about? I can't remember those TV shows. Well, you know, the talent show. What is it? I can't remember. Hell with it. All right. So Chertoff says that he wonders if all the plotters were caught. Now, that makes me a little nervous. I'm going to fly in a little while. Friends of mine are flying right now. And what the hell? That'd be pretty bad if all the plotters weren't caught, assuming that this was a plot of any real substance. Well, how about this? There was an election last Tuesday in Connecticut. And this right-wing Democrat, Joe Lieberman, was thrown out by the voters in Connecticut. They said, we don't want this guy. He's like Bush light. He's a Republican light. He got a kiss from Bush. He votes with the Republicans on a lot of issues that are really important. And Ned Lamont, just kind of a centrist, I mean, he's not a very radical guy or anything like that, won the election. So old Joe, the old war horse, the guy who has been feeding at the public trough for 18 years, he's not going to accept the people's decision. He's going to run as an independent, see if he can wreck the Democrats' attempt to regain control of at least one house of the Congress. Now, here, but this is important. This is extraordinarily important. So Chertoff wonders, did we catch everybody? And why wouldn't we have caught everybody? I mean, how could these people have slipped through the net? One way is that the arrests were premature. that the investigation hadn't been fully developed, wasn't completed, hadn't gone towards the end. Why wouldn't it do that? Why wouldn't the Brits make sure that every single person was caught? Well, listen to this from BuzzFlash.com. NBC just confirmed, and you can find this link on my site, peterwerbe.com, P-E-T-E-R-W-E-R-B-E. NBC just confirmed that the White House forced the UK, the United Kingdom, to move up the timing of the alleged terror cell arrest against the recommendations of the British intelligence agencies. Is that all clear? Michael Chertoff says, I wonder if all the plotters were caught. NBC says on its site, and you can go to my site and see that the White House forced the Brits to move up the timing of the alleged terror cell arrest against the recommendations of the British intelligence agency. So now, why would they do that? Well, here's some more sentences. This is from BuzzFlash.com. By so doing, the Bush administration compromised the investigation and kept it from obtaining further evidence and contact names. In short, for purposes of political timing, in order to make partisan points like the election of Ned Lamont, the Bush administration compromised our national security. Once again, I would add, beginning with the most catastrophic compromise, which was 9/11. Furthermore, NBC confirms that British sources indicate that the alleged terrorist plan was not near operational. Indeed, some of the would-be hijackers did not even have passports. This is an extraordinary betrayal of America's national security, purely done, says BuzzFlash, so that Cheney, Snow, and Bush could attack the Democrats as weak on national security, knowing that the arrest announcement was going to be made on Wednesday because they picked the day of the arrest. These people are extraordinarily dangerous, and they are in the government of the United States. This is all meant to frighten Americans to voting Republican. The only viable winning platform of the Bush now, and remember, they cannot afford either House of Congress to become Democratic because it would likely lead to investigations and the impeachment and prosecution of senior administration staff. And it goes on. You can read all of it. Bush hasn't reduced terrorism. He has increased its threat. Look at the media this week. The alleged British terror plot dominates the leads in television, radio, and newspapers around the nation. Fear is a powerful tool. It goes right from the media into the brain. It appeals to our reptilian sense of self-protection. From the Philadelphia Daily News, the headline says, some people have no shame. Their contempt for democracy is so great they will stop at nothing to undermine it. Their adherence to fundamentalist belief that blinds them to reality is frightening. They must be stopped. And this is just the Republicans, says this editorial. Let's start with Vice President Dick Cheney. Yesterday, Cheney bashed those who voted for Democrat Ned Lamont in the Connecticut Senate primary, claiming that these votes would encourage Al-Qaeda types to think they can break the will of the American people. People vote out this man, this Democrat, who embraced Bush, literally, even to the point of a kiss after a State of the Union speech. They voted instead for Ned Lamont, who represents the view of 60% of the American people who think Iraq is absolutely and totally down the drain. And what they are trying to salvage out of a surefire defeat in November is to once again cry wolf, terrorism, fear. If you haven't seen V for Vendetta, V for Vendetta, it's right on the front of brought it back to the front of my website, peterwerbe.com, W-E-R-B-E.com. See that movie. It's available now in DVD. Well, I want to hear from you, too. I'm Peter Werbe. This is Night Call. There's more on the Lamont campaign. Let me see if there's anything in here that is worth... This is amazing. I mean, it takes a multimillionaire like Ned Lamont to defeat an old war horse from the Democratic Party like... Joe Lieberman. Hillary Clinton is facing somebody much to the left of Ned Lamont, who's not very far to the left at all. His name is Jonathan Tassini. Jonathan Tassini, T-A-S-I-N-I, T-A-S-I-N-I. Check him out. And he is going to be running against Hillary in the Democratic primary on September 12th. Doesn't have a snowball's chance in hell. And why? As it says here in the New York Times, a largely unknown figure to most New Yorkers, Mr. Tassini has raised about $150,000, according to his campaign. That's a lot of money, $150,000. However, this is a mere pittance compared with the roughly $22 million in Mrs. Clinton's campaign coffers. So we're not looking at democracy here. We're not looking at democracy here at all. We're talking about who can buy their way into office and who can stay in office by spending the most amount of money, and where do they get the money from? That's the real question. Most Democrats are very pleased that Lieberman got defeated. From the nearly 4 out of 5 Democrats, almost 80% were happy the former Democratic vice presidential nominee Joe Lieberman got knocked off by Lamont. So nearly 2 in 3, 62% say they believe the results of the Kinetic primary will hold national implications for the elections coming up this fall. And 70% of Democrats said they think the Lamont victory in Connecticut makes the Democratic Party stronger heading into the important election season. Gee, a Democratic Party with just a little bit of guts? Can't believe it. All right, I'd like to hear from you. I'm Peter Werby, and our phone number here in Detroit, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Little while, I want to talk about George Bush. George Bush is reading Albert Camus, the famed existentialist author. I can't even begin to give you a hint of what this implies, or I'll be off on another rave. Let's go first to our phones, and our first caller is Christopher. Christopher is in Lake Orion. Hi, Christopher. Peter Werby here with you on WRIF.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
How are you doing tonight?
Excellent. Thank you for asking.
I had a couple points I wanted to make. First was concerning the cluster bombs. I believe those fall under like the anti-landmine treaty in terms of if they're illegal or not. If a country signs on to it, that's how that would work.
Okay.
But my question first goes over is if Israel initiated the violence with Hezbollah.
Uh-huh.
My understanding was that during the Lebanese Civil War, the PLO was operating out of southern Lebanon. In response to this, to a continued amount of attacks, Israel occupied southern Lebanon, I believe, until they left in 2000 under a UN mandate.
Right, 18 years.
Yep, correct.
Yeah. By the way, we ought to maybe compliment Israel, because when their last invasion and destruction of Lebanon in 1982, they killed 20,000 civilians, and this time looks like it's probably going to be about 10% of that, probably a couple thousand. So they're doing better.
Well, understandably, but my question concerns is when Syria pulled out and they left Hezbollah in there, and Hezbollah basically occupied a state within a state because the Lebanese central government was not able to facilitate them leaving. Israel's hope in pulling out was to cede that land, and the Lebanese would take over, and Hezbollah would disarm. Unfortunately, that did not happen. My question is this: is if there's a continuing amount of rockets fired into Israel, what would be the appropriate response?
Well, Hezbollah has not been firing any large number of rockets. What Israel has to do, if Israel authentically wants peace, that they have to begin with a process of creating justice for the Palestinians, settle those land disputes there, and come overwhelmingly to a peaceful settlement on all outstanding issues, including, you know, holding prisoners, like I say, disputed land, Golan Heights, Sheba Farms, all of that. There's some thought that Israel does not want any peace settlement, and the last thing in the world they want is what most people say, and Israel gives lip service to, but these same people don't think they have any serious intent for it, is to have a parallel Palestinian state that is viable and that has all the rights of another nation. So that just when groups like Hezbollah is becoming much, much more like a political party and less like an army, when the political wing of Hamas looks like it's getting ready to change its historic view on the right of Israel to exist, that's when Israel attacks. I mean, Israel has attacked Hamas leaders when in the midst of ceasefires. And, I mean, the whole damn thing is a mess. I mean, I don't want to, like I'm making some brief for these right-wing fundamentalist theocrats that represented by Hamas and Hezbollah. But Hezbollah means the party of God. I mean, what talk about? What do you think who's representative on earth you are? But if this isn't going to be settled by the outstanding issues on a basis of justice, this is going to go on forever. And Israel can, I mean, as it is, it took an enormous pasting from this Hezbollah army. Calling them guerrillas, I think, mistakes it. They had one of the biggest losses, with 25 soldiers yesterday. I mean, they want peace with no resistance to the policies that they dictate for the region, for the people that they dispossess from good portions of land that they occupy. It ain't going to happen. This will continue on for another century. And I'm advocating, and you could, for one thing, you might just say, forget all of that. The main thing that we ought to do is we shouldn't be supplying one of the belligerents with these weapons of mass destruction, like F-16s, like these tanks, like these cluster bombs, like these so-called precision bombs. What the hell are we doing that for? What are we spending our money on that for when we have so many crying needs in this country? All right, Christopher, thank you. Appreciate it very much. 313-298-WRIF. Here is Nick. Nick's in Detroit. Hi, Nick. You're on the air.
Hey, what's up, Peter?
Just doing the show. What's up with you?
Long-time fan, man. I dig hearing you, man, but you're probably going to hang up on me.
Okay. Well, should I do it now or?
No, hang on. Dude, my other friend has the radio on.
Oh, okay.
No, I mean, you know, Peter, I mean, I love you, man, all the time.
You suck!
All the time, you know, you do your thing. I appreciate that. But, man, every week you're a different subject. Peter, what do you really stand for, man?
Oh, I'm not going to hang up for that. But you think what should I take? Should I? We're close to hanging up. Oh, yeah, okay. Well, there we're hanging up. All right, let's go to Patrick in West Bloomfield. Patrick, hi, you're on the air.
Hello. Hey, I'd just like to say that Bush is really crabby.
Sure, what's up with you?
And we're going to be like a third-class nation before you know it. And everything they were saying on the church, on like Woodward, McLaughlin, is coming true. The yellow man, and I'm not a racist by any stretch of the imagination. I'm the most liberal guy in the world.
But
the yellow man is going to take it over. And
well, I'll tell you. I'm sorry. Go ahead. China what?
They're going to come in here and drink our water and, like, take us over and kick us out with North Korea. That's, like, their pawn, like, our Israel, like, our, like,
well, listen, here, you say you're not a racist, so I would not use language that has to do with race. But empires rise and they fall. And very frequently, over the last 400 years or so, the major empires being European and now the U.S., it's always because they overextend. They, for one thing, that so much of their resources is taken up in military expenditures and trying to control these empires and fighting endless wars. So we're fighting that pattern that Spain and Britain and the Netherlands and France, all of them did. So are we going to go into eclipse to Asian countries, which I think would be a much, much better way to say that no one will even suspect that you're a racist. But right now, Japan, China, Taiwan, and South Korea hold about 40% of our government debt. Because, as you, I think it was you that said, Bush is crappy, as you put it, indelicately, not elegantly, but I'll take that. Come to play an enormous and little noticed role in sustaining the American housing boom. And this author says, read that twice. We owe our housing boom to China because they want to keep, they want us to keep buying all the stuff that they manufacture. So, I mean, we're sort of in each other's thrall, if you will. But the idea that Bush has driven this country into debt, and everybody that's got a credit card, the vast majority of you, you know, have a, you know, don't pay it off, and you pay interest on it. Well, that's what we're doing with our income. So you and I, we pay taxes. Some of it goes to Israel. Some of it goes to, you know, to Egypt and Jordan, other countries that they can buy stuff to make their horrible wars with. And a good part of it, too, goes for debt service, interest on the national debt that Bush has created because of his wars and cutting taxes for his rich buddies, which does not make a bit of sense. And what you say is going to happen, Patrick, could very well.
Like a song you just heard?
Oh, yeah!
Listen up. Then head on over to the Digital Riff Music Store at WRIF.com and download your favorite riff tunes for just 99 cents.
Next song.
Stay connected. With 101 WRIF and WRIF.com. Everything that rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
WRIF.com. Hanging around downtown.
and I had so much time to sit and think about myself, and then there she was, like double cherry pie. Yeah, there she was, like disco superfly. I smell sex and candy hair. Who's that lounging in my chair? Who's that casting devious stares in my direction? Mama, this surely is a dream. Yeah, yeah, mama, this surely. Caffeine, and I was thinking about myself, and then there she was. In class.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to the show. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. While during the break, I was just watching a Yahoo slideshow of the destruction of Beirut. It looks like Berlin after World War II. Israel trying to get its last licks in. Hezbollah firing hundreds of rockets. I mean, for all the rockets that they've launched, they've done relatively little. I mean, I forgot how many. Isn't it hundreds and hundreds and hundreds? I guess they don't have the precision bombs like the United States supplies Israel with. This is from Bill. He writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. A caller last week mentioned David, I think we were saying Icky. I think it's pronounced Ake, I-C-K-E, and the Illuminati. Pardon me. Ake, I'm going to call him, has very eccentric views. He claims that George W. Bush, the British royal family, and most world leaders are not human. Rather, they are reptilian aliens, hell-bent on dominating the human race. Also, they must drink human blood to maintain their metamorphic state, whatever that is. He claims if you pay close attention to videos, you can see their eyes as reptilian for brief moments. And Bill says, I feel that calling somebody crazy is the height of arrogance because it is an abandonment of any hope of understanding. But this guy is crazy. You think? I don't know. I mean, take a look at their eyes. Just take a look at their eyes. All right, let's go back to our phone calls. This is Night Call on WRIF, and let's make our program international. Go to Ali in Windsor. Ali, hi. You're on the air.
Hi, sir. How are you?
I'm doing excellent. Thanks for calling in.
Okay. I was wondering if you can, if you are a good listener. I'm a Lebanese man living in Canada, Windsor, Ontario.
Okay.
And I just come from Lebanon last week. What do you like to know about the facts, what is happening exactly in Lebanon? I can tell you exactly, and God is a witness, what is happening to us.
Please tell us. I think we need some first-hand accounts. We've seen a lot on the television, but if you were there, I'd like to hear what impressed you, what remains on your mind the most, what scenes, what images?
The images, sir. I am from south of Lebanon, from a village on south Lebanon called Tibnin. Part of what I am from, I'm a Muslim, and I can call myself, I'm a Shia'i, but I'm not from Hezbollah.
Okay.
And I am one of the most beautiful country on the Middle East, which is holding 17 different religions, and which is why we are very succeeded in this country, and which we are, I can tell ourselves, we are a democratic country.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing I would like to say, Lebanon is a disaster country, and we are a ground zero. I can say 75% of Lebanon, especially the south of Lebanon, is to the ground.
Wow.
Beirut, the suburb of Beirut, where is the place called Dahye, where I used to call, where Hezbollah was been there, almost 100 and over 20 buildings has been to the ground. And for your information, last week, and when I was there from the beginning of the war to the third week. We had been heard and seen and witnessed bombs like we had never heard in our entire life. I have been witness three different wars in Lebanon. The invasion of 1982 of Israel, the invasion of Israel in 1993, and the invasion and of the massacre of Cana in south of Lebanon in 1996. And now, which is the most horrible war we had ever witnessed in our life. What you see on TV, especially in the United States, it's part what you see because most of it has been edited.
Well, Ali, what happened to your village? Were you there? I mean, you said you were in your home village?
Yes, sir. I was there for like 2 weeks, and I had a miracle to get out, me, my dad, my mom, and we had been in a hospital in our village. We didn't have any supplying food. The only thing we had, just the bread from the Red Cross. And today, my village is under bombing. We have 370 people are wounded. They are civilians. They are in the hospital. They need a special care. They need food. They didn't have any supply since I left my village, which was 3 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And one other thing I would like to say it. Hezbollah never been found in Lebanon before this sixth invasion of Israel to Lebanon. Hezbollah was found in 1982 because Israel, every time somebody had to do something with south of Lebanon, they came and bombarding us by airplane, whatever weapon they can get to us.
Well, Ali, how do you feel about the fact that the United States supplies all of these weapons of war to Israel?
I can tell you, I'm one of the Lebanese people, lived in Canada and live abroad in Lebanon. I can talk about myself, and I know most of the Lebanese people that are holding U.S. Canadian citizen and U.S. passport and Canadian citizen. We have no problem with American or Canadian or any foreigner country. We love you guys like anybody in the world. Lebanon was one of the most peaceful country in the world. The only thing we are against is the policy. Why the United States has to give Israel these bombs? Today, I had called my parents. There was a building has been collapsed with one single hit.
Boy.
Some of these blasted bombs, which is the airplanes been hitting us, are on civilian casualties. Today's number from Lebanon, I talked to my dad, is 1,300 people are being killed. 60% of them, God is witness what I'm saying, are kids under the age of 12. Some of the victims, to be honest with you, anybody in the world will cry for them, was 1 day old. They didn't even see the light. For which sanity, which religion in the world will say that? Why we have to pay a price for something we don't deserve it? We are a very peaceful country. Hezbollah is not a fundamental militia. I am one of the Shiites who are living in south of Lebanon. Most of Hezbollah are families. We are cousins. I know them, been sitting, eating with them. They are people, they are protecting us because our government is so poor. We don't have an army because the United States is not allowing us to have airplanes or heavy-duty bombing.
Well, Ali, actually, it must be so disturbing. And what's interesting, I heard a BBC program where they had children from Lebanon, about 12 or 13, and they had children from Israel talking. And when it comes down to it, everybody just wants to live with their families, live in peace, and it's not going to be peaceful unless there is a resolution of the fundamental issues. And no one, I mean, here, Israel, the strongest army, all supplied with the most technological weapons of war imaginable from the United States with our tax dollars. And still, they cannot defeat Hezbollah. And it might turn out to be that Hezbollah has killed more Israeli soldiers than Israelis. Soldiers have killed Hezbollah fighters. And so they've got to find another way, or this is just going to be happening over and over again. All right. Thank you so much. And the destruction of your country was certainly undeserved. You know, I forgot to tell this story, too. The reason that I keep talking about what's happened in Lebanon and the reasons for all this, because this isn't told. There's only one side told in the American media, and that's overwhelmingly pro-Israeli, rather than giving both sides of it. If you go to European media, you get both sides, like the British BBC does. And, I mean, that's one of the reasons that Israel won't cooperate with the BBC, because they give both sides of things, that they report fully on it. They give both arguments. They give both facts as it's presented by both sides. But mostly, although there's certainly been casualties among the Israelis from Katyusha rockets, and there's been Israeli casualties over the years, they've mostly been able to escape the consequences that the Arab peoples, the Lebanese and the Palestinians have over the last 50 years or so. And this, what's happening to them of living in fear? I mean, you've seen the films. I mean, those you've seen pretty much. I actually like that. Some of the films, the footage have been pretty good in both countries. But when you look in people's eyes, when you look in Israeli citizens' eyes, and when you look at Lebanese citizens' eyes, the civilians, you see the fear. You see what they thought was going to be their life of living it out in peace with their families, of working with their jobs and going to movies and having picnics and all of that. Suddenly there's terror. The idea that they don't know when the next rocket or bomb is going to hit. And mostly people in Israel were free from that. There was some. I mean, they began, you know, when these, the retaliations by suicide bombings, then that was probably this. I mean, all the Israelis I've talked to are indeed terrorized by that. But a friend of mine who may be listening in London right now, but he was in a Hezbollah village on September 11, 2001. There wasn't anything there for political stuff at all. He's a wine and food writer, and he was doing material on the food and the food and drink of Lebanon. And all of a sudden, in this village, had big posters of the Iranian Ayatollah Khomeini on there. So suddenly, he hears the news about September 11, and he's got friends in New York, and he's an American, and people came up to him. These were people that see the United States as being the key to what has happened to their country, the destruction of their country by backing Israel, by bombarding their country in 1982, who don't particularly, in essence, who have great resentment, I won't do any understatement, great resentment towards the United States. And they came up to him, and you know what they said? We know how you feel. We know how you feel. They didn't say, now you know how we feel. You got what you deserved. Now you know the same thing was done to you that you're responsible for having done to us. They had, with great compassion, with great empathy, they said, we know how you feel, because that's happened to us over and over again. And now it's happened again. And it's happened to the Israelis as well. And that fear that perhaps Tel Aviv could be bombed, that idea that nowhere in the country of Israel are they safe. Because the Israelis know that the Arabs can lose war after war. Israel can only lose one. That maybe this will be the impetus to say, we can't continue these policies that create such intense hostility. We can't dominate other people to the extent that we have been over the last 50 years. We have to create peace, and peace can only come with justice. Let's go to Susan in Port Huron. Susan, hi, it's Peter Werby, and you're on the air.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, every third Thursday of every month, we do a third Thursday peace and justice rally here in Port Huron, and that information can be found at BlueNovember.org.
What is it? Blue November?
BlueNovember.org. Yes,
okay.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, I have that on my website calendar.
Yeah, thanks for putting it there.
Glad to do it.
Hey, well, we're a group of ordinary citizens, and we are compelled at this time in our lives to work for social transformation. And our activities usually include an invitation to our neighbors, and sometimes that's inciting honking. I know there's a guy in Ferndale that's in trouble for that, and he's one of our friends, Victor Katilla. I'm sure you know him.
I do indeed. Yeah.
Yeah. And we call on our neighbors here in St. Clair County to join us in demanding a just society and, of course, an immediate end to the Iraq war.
You know, I take part in demonstrations all the time, so I'm doing, if I lived any closer, I'd probably be up there. just like I was supporting Victor and the people in Ferndale when they had vigils on the corner. But, you know, there's actually something wrong with the fact that we have to do that. You know what I mean? That the reason that you're making your voice heard is because it's really been thrown to you. It's not like the other countries where they have a vibrant opposition party. You know what I'm saying? No.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, our government has failed in the advocacy of people.
Yeah. On the other hand, I like it when people take things into their own hand, because how many people have you been getting up there at your vigil in Port Huron, Susan?
We had about 40 at the last one.
Okay. So what we really need is about 40,000.
Absolutely.
That would change things, because we know that 60% of the American people agree with us. We are the majority. And yet people have not found a way to express themselves, or that we've gotten out of the habit of publicly expressing ourselves. And we just hope that Susan and the other 39 people in Port Huron will do it.
Well, you know, it's like we're being strangled by this insidious snake that is our government, and that 50% of us are still willingly choking down the lies. And I think that that's the big problem, is that 50% of us are still not willing to wake up.
Well, Susan, you know, the Lincoln dictum about fooling all the people some of the time, that's what Bush did after 9/11, and you can fool some of the people all the time. Well, those, you know, the remaining third, those are the people that want to be fooled. They're the people that will be fooled, all the time, because they want to be. All right, so it's BlueNovember.org. You can join Susan and the other people this coming Thursday, is it?
Yes, sir.
All right, I got to go.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you, Susan. Peace out. Bye.
This is WRIF.com.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to our second hour. Night Call brought to you this hour by Waking Up, Metro Detroit's sweatshop free clothing store. It's located in the Universal Mall at 12 Mile Road in DeQuinder in Warren. You can go to their website, wakingupstore.com. Remember, the Waking Up Green Expo, Saturday, September 16th. I am going to be speaking. Come on out. Ought to be a lot of great organizations and businesses dedicated to a green world. We're talking in part, actually conjoining all of these elements of the United States' imperial presence in the Middle East. I say get the hell out 100%. Stop spending any of our money in Iraq, in Israel, in Egypt, in Jordan, anywhere. And we will diminish our problems probably down to zero, particularly if we were instrumental in bringing peace with justice there. I mean, we may have just destroyed any possibility of that, and this is going to be endless chaos for the rest of our life. That's a possibility as well. That plot, I was saying this earlier and reading from a BuzzFlash.com editorial that NBC has confirmed that the White House forced Britain to move up the timing of the alleged terror cell arrest against the recommendations of the British intelligence agencies. They did that so it could follow immediately the defeat by hack Joe Lieberman, the Democratic Party hack, Republican light, and his defeat by Ned Lamont, because that's the only way that the Republicans figure they can hold on to power and not let any majority appear of Democrats in either the House or the Senate. If they do that, that means they will control the committees and they will start investigating all the crimes, all of the sellouts, all of the corruption that the Republicans have presided over for the last 6 years. So they will do anything to ensure that that does not occur. Did you get this? This is a little side note, and I was going to go on about it because I've been reading extensively about it this evening. U.S. President George W. Bush, where is this from? Breitbart.com. So Bush quoted French existentialist writer Albert Camus. Looks like Camus or C-A-M-U-S, Albert Camus, and he quoted him to European leaders a year ago, and now he's read one of the writer's most famous works, The Stranger. This is an incredibly, one hand, disturbing, on the other hand, Camus meant it as a liberating book. It's inconceivable that George W. Bush could read this, accept its message, and still be George W. Bush. He would resign. He would absolutely resign. He quoted Camus in a speech in February 2005. He said that, why would he, this is a speechwriter, obviously. We know that there are many obstacles, and we know that the road is long. Albert Camus said that, quote, freedom is a long-distance race. I mean, it doesn't sound exactly what Camus would say, but maybe. He's written a number of books, The Myth of Sisyphus, that had a big effect on me, The Rebel. Those are nonfictions. It's sort of an exposition of his philosophy. But he also wrote a number of novels that were novel, told a story, but also involved this philosophy of existentialism, which is, I don't know, if you read these big, long Kierkegaard and Sartre and stuff like that, I would look at that and say, what the hell are they talking about? I know some of you can understand that. I cannot get my brain around it at all. But simply said, I know all you Wayne State and U of M guys are going to just say, that's not what it's about, Pete. But as I understand existentialism, it's the world is absurd in the sense that it has no inherent meaning, that there is no God, that there is no ultimate purpose in life. And then it falls upon us through our lives to invest it with meaning, to live it to its fullest. But most importantly to me is that it asks when we choose, each time we choose an ethical act or an ethical path, we are choosing for everyone. So that when we commit a single act, that act has to be universalized. So if we steal, then that universalizes theft. If we hurt, it universalizes injury, and on like that. So it means expression to what do we do in a world that comes to us in the manner that it has. Now, Bush reading The Stranger by Albert Camus is absolutely inconceivable. For one thing, the protagonist is an atheist, and at the end, he is convicted of killing someone, and a priest is brought to him, and he almost physically—it's been so long since I read it—either almost does physically attack him and tells him, you know, to get out, and it expresses Camus' atheistic feelings. To some extent, his left feelings, Camus was in the resistance during World War II, and he edited the left-wing journal Combat. So how is Bush reading this? Think about the choices that Bush has made, and if those are universalized. Well, they're getting to be universalized. Universalized terror, universalized war, universalized triumph of wealth over need, the wealthy over the poor. Has he made those choices? But this book would pull him up short. And he said, I couldn't do this and still be a human being. Or maybe that guy Ike, whatever his name is right. Maybe he is reptilian. I have looked in his eyes in some of these videos. Scary. Extraordinarily scary. Cindy Sheehan is out of the hospital. She was hospitalized with dehydration down in Crawford and a minor gynecological procedure, and she's back and going to be carrying on more actions at Camp Casey, where she now has purchased land near Bush's little summer retreat, where he goes when something awful is going to happen, like 911, and pay no attention to what's happening. But this is interesting. Where was this? I just saw it. Sheehan will rest for the next few days at the home of Willie Nelson and his wife, whom Sheehan has gotten to know during the past year. All right, at 1 a.m. Eastern Time, which is exactly the time that the fighting is supposed to stop in Lebanon, and the last moment, Israel doing the maximum amount of damage, destroying more and more civilian infrastructure, getting in its last licks, courtesy of the United States taxpayer. 1 a.m. Have a couple of very, very interesting interviews, and I'm going to do it the easy way. I'm going to my website, Peter Werbe, PeterWerbe.com. Go right at the top to On Air Guests, and it doesn't open. Let's see. Oh, yeah, there it goes. It's not, I know, because it's already open, isn't it? That's why. All right, so we're going to be talking with Penny Coleman, who has written Flashback, Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder, Suicide, and the Lesson of War. And she talks about her own husband, who was a suicidal Vietnam veteran who killed himself, and what we're going to do with the people now who Bush has thrust into this meaningless war in Iraq, where people die and kill and are killed for Bush's terrible mistakes, a war based on, it's not even a mistake, it wasn't an honest mistake, it was based on a lie. Also, Charles Epping, who is a Swiss banker who's written a book called Trust, which talks about world finances in many ways, but is really this interesting novel about trust funds set up by Jews fleeing the Nazis in the late 1930s, and what happens with an account that was never claimed today that is now worth, in the book, about $400 million. So a couple of interesting guests that's going to be happening in just about 50 minutes or so. Stay with me. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Mike. He's been waiting patiently in Riverview. Mike, hi. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey.
Hey, Mike, you too. It's on the air. Turn your radio off.
I'm sorry?
Turn your radio off.
Okay.
Now, hi. You're on the air.
All right.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. Peter, I just have a couple things to say about the situation with Israel bombing Lebanon, this whole new thing that everyone's talking about. UN resolutions going on. Well, I'm here just to offer a solution. You know,
right.
It's real simple.
What's
Israel
that?
Has to get out of the all Arab-occupied lands. It has to recognize the right of Arabs to live in peace and security. And there has to be a creation of a free and independent Palestine.
Well, I agree. And that's right now is Israel is absolutely not committed to that. And most of they have absolutely no intention of allowing that. But they have two choices, either allow that and allow a legitimate peace with justice to occur, or this will keep happening again and again and again. And you're right, Mike.
I agree, but here's the thing.
Yeah.
We don't even discuss the reasons of why such things happen. You know, we just react and see, oh, these Arabs are attacking Israel. But we have to realize that Israel was created on Palestine. It was created by raping, pillaging, murdering, and plundering the Arab and Palestine. And so it was created like that. It got a lot of resentment from all the Arabs in the area, and it's created problems ever since. Now, these Palestinians, they're being viewed as though they're the ones trying to attack Israel or not get into the sea. But see, they never even recognize that there's Palestinians. They created Israel on the basis that a land for a people, for...
They said the aphorism or something is, a people, a land without people for a people without land.
Yes.
So, in other words,
since then, they haven't been recognizing or treating the Palestinians as humans, literally. They refer to them as cockroaches and terrorists. And my thing is, we can't even talk about the real situation, about how Israel is a big aggressor in the Middle East that was wrongly created on Palestinian lands.
Well, one thing that people have to remember, and it's funny, I was talking with someone last week, and he started off badly, so I didn't deal with the call in probably the way that I should have. But Israel was created by armed resistance to British occupation. They had an underground guerrilla or army called the Irgun. No, wait a minute. The Haganah, rather. But then there were these subgroups like the Irgun and below that, the Stern Gang, that were terrorists, that assassinated UN representatives, that blew up hotels. Many of the right-wing Zionists were sympathetic to the Nazis in the sense that they were, before they knew they were killing the Jews in Europe, but were sympathetic to the Nazis because they were opposed to the British and were trying to create some way they could even, some cooperation. So this is all well known. And two of these terrorists from this terrorist group, the Stern Gang, became prime ministers of of Israel, that was created as an exclusivist religion-based state. That's not a good way to deal having a multicultural or state in which all people are welcome, I'd say. So, the Jewish state, that's kind of weird. If you said you had a Christian state, you'd think, man. And Muslim states, I kind of feel the same way. All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate it, Mike. When you have states based on religion, look out. That's why the United States is a secular country. That's why, I wasn't even going to bring this. I've read this about a million times, and it's so important. The First Amendment to the American Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, says nothing about the rights of the people whatsoever. It doesn't guarantee the first thing. It does in the First Amendment. But it doesn't guarantee free speech. It doesn't guarantee the freedom of the press or the right to assemble. The absolute first thing is Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. The Founding Fathers knew that a country that had an established religion was going to be tyrannical, particularly the people that didn't happen to be in the favored group. And we see that all over the world. People fighting about their religions. Ain't a good basis for human association, I'd say. 313-298-WRIF. All right, I am not seeing on my screen which one to take next. I'll take Susan from Oakland County. He's been waiting a long time. Susan, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Great to hear from you. I want to talk about some of those crimes and corruptions in Washington.
Sure.
Really what I want to talk about is the race in the 9th District for Congress and Joe Nolenberg and some of his crimes.
Uh-huh.
It would appear that Mr. Nolenberg seems to take a lot of funding from lobbyists. He one of his biggest funders is the oil lobby. And he just successfully helped pass a $6 billion tax subsidy to the oil lobby. So you know who's helping to pay for that one, don't you?
Sure, and how he votes.
Yeah. And so I heard Nancy Skinner this Saturday. She is somebody who's running against Joe Nolenberg. And I was very impressed with her as a candidate. Her forthrightness, her honesty, and I'm really quite excited about her as a candidate.
Well, you may know or you may not know, but Nancy Skinner is an old colleague of mine on the from the IE America Radio Network, where I had a nationally syndicated show. And Nancy was a talk show host as well, and is extraordinarily conversant with the issues, and was way out in front. I mean, back in like 02 and 03, when she and I and a guy named Mike Malloy, who's a nationally syndicated talk show host, when we were criticizing Bush, saying, and then started saying he was lying about the run-up to the war, and we were losing stations one after another. People say, They called Bush a liar. They said there weren't weapons of mass destruction. And Nancy was right there with us saying the same thing. So she's got high integrity and she understands the issues.
I just wanted to bring another thing up. I've been in Washington myself doing work and trying to sway politics in unpaid positions, so I would not be considered a lobbyist but merely a citizen.
Yeah.
What I did research is how many lobbyists exist in Washington. Via the Washington Post, there are 34,750 lobbyists as of 2004.
Wow, are you serious? They register.
We're talking close to 35,000 lobbyists. Now, in seats in Congress, that would be the 9th district, hopefully Nancy will get, there are 435 seats in Congress. Well, if you divide that, that's almost 79.8. That's almost 80 lobbyists per seat in Congress.
They've been all over them.
So let's see. Who's got more influence over Congress, us or the lobbyists?
Yeah, you got it. Well,
do you know the average pay of a lobbyist?
I give up.
$300,000.
That's more than I make.
More than I make, too.
Yeah, I think it's probably more than you and I make. Put together. Yeah. Well, you can go to Skinner for Congress, not like Leonard Skinner, but S-K-I-N-N-E-R, SkinnerForCongress.com. And Nancy is running in communities like
Berkeley, Bloomfield, Royal Oak, Birmingham. I'm in Farmington.
Yeah.
So I have to say she's a dynamic speaker, very energetic.
Joe has got to go.
Yeah.
Both in Connecticut and in the 9th District in Michigan. Get Nancy Skinner in there.
I say check out Nolenberg. That's what I say.
Joe's got to go.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Susan. I appreciate you calling 313-298-WRIF. Marion from Dearborn's really been waiting a long time. My apologies. Welcome to the broadcast.
Yes, hi. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
First, I want to thank you for your enlightening words of wisdom. What I'm trying to understand is, why is Hezbollah considered a terrorist group? I know they formed after the Israeli invasion in Lebanon, and their mission was to free their country.
Yeah, they were fighting as Israel did against the British occupation. Hezbollah was fighting against the Israeli occupation.
Correct. And I know that they are considered a terrorist group, and I know in the United States that if you, you're a supporter or if you mention them, you're considered a terrorist.
Well, let me back up from that pronoun. The United States government and the American media, which shapes a lot of American opinion, unfortunately, it depends. If you ask the average American who has been the recipient of the most violence, like Palestinians or Israelis, most people would probably say Israelis, but most of the figures are anywhere from 3-1 to 10-1, depending on what categories, like in children killed, civilians killed, housing destroyed, that the media is so overwhelmingly sympathetic to Israel that you'd never know that the people on the other side have been suffering catastrophic casualties and repression and the worst kind of tyranny imaginable.
Correct.
But you know, Miriam, when you are going to take land from people, when you essentially ethnically cleanse an area like Palestine in order to set up a religious exclusive estate, And you don't, you know, like in here in the United States, we ethnically cleanse the native people from their land, dispossess them, and we killed most of them. So they're not around to bug us. They're not around to be able to launch any resistance towards us. But the majority of the Palestinian people, of course, although there's been a diaspora that's brought people all over the world, they're still around, and they're not very happy either what happened nor what continues to happen to them on a day-to-day basis. So essentially what Israel wants is peace with no resistance.
Correct.
And they wanted, the reason that they don't like Hamas is they wanted Fatah to essentially be, and I hope I'm not stepping on people start calling, that they wanted Fatah to essentially to be the colonial police, to keep in check those elements that still wanted to launch military attacks against Israel as a way of driving them out of the land on the West Bank and Gaza that Israel illegally occupies.
Mm-hmm. And one thing I would like to mention is I was in Syria about 2 weeks ago, and there is a 500,000 Lebanese in Syria right now with absolutely nothing. They're staying in public schools, and they're suffering. And you see a lot of the children and the people are mentally ill because they've lost a lot of family members, and they have nowhere to stay. And then I hear that the people in Syria are preparing themselves because they know that they're next. The war is going to extend to Syria.
You know, I don't know. I mean, I hope I'm wrong. I don't think it's going to happen. This hasn't worked out very well for Israel. It certainly has been the biggest catastrophe for Lebanon, the Lebanese people. I mean, when you start having hundreds of thousands of people driven from their home. And one of the saddest things, Miriam, is that Americans kind of take it for granted that this happens in other parts of the world. Mm-hmm. But if anyone could actually empathize with people and think about, if they were being driven from Brighton or Westland or Ann Arbor or Northville or Warren, something like that, and their houses destroyed, their villages destroyed because the Canadian Army had decided that some forces here had captured a couple of soldiers. It's unimaginable to us. I don't know. What more I can say, actually. But tell me, how what was the feeling in Syria? So.
It's just very sad because everybody's trying to help these people, and now schools are supposed to open for the Syrians in September, and they're going to postpone school for the next month because they have nowhere to keep the Lebanese except the public schools. So now it's affecting the Syrian children. They're not going to continue their education until a month from now. That's if the war stops and if the Lebanese can return back to their land.
Well, one of the reasons, and there's a lot of supporters of Israel that thinks that Israel is solely the victim of Palestinian and Arab aggression, and that that they, Israel, just want to live peacefully and what have you. And I'm sure, you know, the individual citizens do, but like I said, until there's some justice, this isn't going to happen. But one of the things, you know, you know what Hasidim are? They're these ultra-religious Jews. Mm-hmm. And there is a group of them, very small, a minority of them, that are anti-Zionist, that think that the only time that Israel should be established is when the true Messiah comes. I mean, that's their religious belief. I don't share that. But they say the current Israel is a false Messiah that's going to lead the Jews to their doom. And they may be on to something because, among other things, like right now, Israel can depend on the unwavering support of both political parties in the United States and the United States government. Our tax dollars have been spent tens of billions of dollars, maybe even probably hundreds of billions of dollars. Yeah. But, you know, things change. And it could be with an expanding Arab population in the United States that all of a sudden the support that Israel has enjoyed all these years could suddenly evaporate. And all of a sudden they'd be left out there saying, hey, maybe let's negotiate. And it might be too late for that. So they ought to take this as a real lesson, even though they were the ones that killed the most civilians and destroyed the whole infrastructure of a country, and say, we got to give up a lot. We've got to give up the manner in which we thought we were going to run things here, or this is going to happen again too many times.
Yes.
All right, Marion, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Peter.
I appreciate it. Mm-hmm. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
And this, by the way, is survival for everyone concerned. And I'm not, you know, you say, gee, this guy is so anti-Israel. Maybe he's even anti-Semitic because he's critical of Israel. Who would be critical of Israel if they didn't dislike Jews? Well, it's coming from the opposite thing. Is my concern, I mean, first you got to look at who's been the major people victimized in the Middle East. And it's not the Israelis. It's not the Jews. All right. But still, people, they're there. I mean, we're not going to, I mean, there's some people that talk about a binational, regional government of Jews and Muslims and all that. That's not going to happen. It's important for the survival of everyone so that this doesn't keep occurring to resolve the issues in the Middle East. And the United States, and it's been exacerbated under Bush 1 and Bush 2 and Clinton, I don't get off on that. I mean, I don't have any love for them either, his administration particularly, but have continued this intervention in a non-productive manner. There's got to be something different or keep expecting this to continue. I'm going to get this call first, Al, just because it's from Ann Arbor and it's been waiting a while. Christian, hi, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello, Peter.
Hi.
Hi, I'm a first-time caller. I really enjoy the show.
Thank you.
I have several comments I'd like to make, several points regarding some of the previous callers and what they said.
Yeah.
The first one I'd like to make, it's in response to the fact that, of course, you know, China, Taiwan, and Japan do have 40%, you know, they can't call 40% of the debt in this country. But in the past 3 years, since 2003, the GNP, the total gross surplus of the GNP in this past 3 years has equaled the entire GNP of communist China. So, I mean, and a lot of it's been credited to the tax cuts that was authorized by Congress and by the president. And then the second point.
That's what the Republicans say. I don't think any economist takes that seriously, but go ahead.
And the second point, I mean, that's just a point by itself. But the second point I'd like to make is your point about the fate of empires. And particularly the fate of the British Empire, which I think is our greatest historical correlation to where our foreign policy is going, especially in Iraq. And the British Empire, I think, is really the only empire, except for, you know, that didn't collapse like the Soviet Union or any other empire. And they essentially dissolved into a series of democratic states. And after they released India in 1947, the British military refocused control on the Mesopotamia and, of course, the Suez Canal, which at the time was the largest military installation in the world.
And Africa.
Africa.
They fought all these wars in Africa to maintain their colonies.
So, and I'm just saying that, you know, if there's any reason why the British Empire kind of mitigated itself, it's because of the United States, not necessarily because they overextended themselves. And there was an article, I believe it was in Newsweek a few weeks ago, and that there was a lieutenant colonel, who graduated from Oxford University, and he just recently wrote a new manual on counterinsurgency, and how to deal with that. And he pointed to two successful operations, and one of them was the British counterinsurgency operation in Malaysia, and that was, of course, to get rid of the communists there.
It's kind of old stuff. People have been writing about that for a long time. I mean, now they're starting to run into Hezbollah type organized militias. I got to go, Christian. Thank you very much for your comments. We'll be right back.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Radio Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in a contest.
void where prohibited. Prices are non-transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any price for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, One Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Welcome to our final segment. 313-298-WRIF. 313-298-9743. Couple open lines. First time tonight. You got something to say? Let's hear from you. Another patient listener is Sebastian and Warren. Sebastian, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
How you doing, Peter?
Doing great.
Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I agree with a lot of points you're saying. This is the first time I heard your show. I don't know how long you've been on the Riff, but I do like what I hear.
A couple years? At least, yeah.
Well, I'm just blown away to hear some way you're expressing yourself, your opinions on the air. I was just wondering how you feel about 9/11 and people calling out for a new investigation.
Well, it doesn't look like this one was complete when we find out that the Pentagon was lying to the commission and everything. By the way, let me just say this, Sebastian. The fact that you say that, and probably you haven't heard very much like this on the air, the real question is why not? And I'm not saying anything that's extraordinarily unusual in the sense that there's a great body of information and opinion and fact and perspectives available like mine. In fact, sometimes I've had a couple people say, you know, you're anti-Semitic. I say, hey, go to, I list on my site about 8 or 10 Jewish and Israeli peace groups, and everything I say is there, and sometimes in much, much stronger terms. So the real question is, why are we only getting one side of the question? Why is it that I'm unusual on the air, whereas I should be like 50% of the information that's on the air? Right? Yeah.
That is a good question. I wonder that every day when I turn on CNN and Fox News, where you just hear the same thing over and over and over, and it's just the same old lies.
Well, let me ask you a question, Sebastian. I know this is not really why you called, but why do you watch them? I mean, they're useless as information sources.
I don't watch them at all. I use the internet for my information.
There you go.
I just like to hear what, you know, people are getting lied to. So, you know, when you do talk to other people, it's what they're kind of know what they're, you know.
Well, you know what? That is interesting. I never used to watch, I don't even have cable television. I don't even find it that worthwhile. But I do that in real crisis periods, like you, very much like what you're saying, Sebastian. I agree with you. Is I turn on, watch ABC News, watch when I come to work, I watch CNN News, because I want to see what are they focusing on? What are they projecting? Well, you know, whenever there's any a big event, like a some people get busted for a terror plot. Man, it's like we just escaped doomsday, right?
Yeah, exactly. And then they don't, a few weeks later, when it's no big deal and the big terrorists were just young kids or just the whole story was just, it's all in the back of the paper. You don't hear the, you know, follow-up on the story. You just hear the big headlines of scared of people.
Well, I'm curious about this one because they've gone to quite a few lengths to make sure that we all believe this was authentic. But like I always tell people on the program, I always wait. I assume they're lying, and then I wait for a while and find out, well, maybe you say, maybe this time they're telling the truth. But you really get in trouble just believing everything you hear on, here on the radio or on the television. Even
yeah,
this.
The mainstream.
Yeah. All right. Well, hey, welcome to the broadcast, Sebastian. Thanks for calling in, and we'll maybe talk a little more about 911 next time. Oh, let me ask you, did you go see the Oliver Stone movie?
No, I haven't.
I haven't either, and I don't know, I don't think I'm going to. I don't know if I want to see that. It's too horrible. I'm not sure I want to relive that. All right. Thanks a lot. Here's Paul in Brighton. Paul, hi. You're on the air. Hey, Paul. Paul's listening to his radio. Hey, Paul, you're on the air.
Hi.
Go ahead. Hi.
Yeah. Oh, well, what do? Everybody talks about peace. I guess the first thing that we should do is, like, learn how to put our weapons down and just get along with our neighbor. Now, what I've learned isn't everything that they're taught is the same thing from the Christianity, and the love thy neighbor doesn't mean get up and get mad because they're not believing what you believe and shoot them.
Well, so, I'll tell you, Paul, almost...
And that's kind of funny, your point with the Canadian border, which has been the most... Oh, we have the friendliest border you could ever have. And kudos to that guy who came to Canada. And they all believe in love thy neighbor, peace among men. And we have these few erratic people that are there and make it worse for all of them.
There you go. That's exactly where I was going to go. I'm glad I let you finish and say it. Yeah, 80-90% of everybody just wants to just get along, and if you, no matter if you're different religion or different color or different sexual orientation or whatever, most people, even if they don't like it or don't, but they just go, okay, you know, I'm just living my life. I'm going to my job. I'm, you know, checking on my friends. And even sometimes people don't like other people, but they don't act on it. But first, you then have entering the picture these people that want to whip everybody up for their own either mad purposes or for their sometimes just for financial stuff. And like, you know, this war in Iraq just being about oil. But they're quite mad. I mean, just nobody is going to preside over all this violence, you know, simply so they can make a few million dollars more. Maybe they are. Thank you, Paul. Appreciate your call. Tom in Westland. Tom, hi. It's Peter Werby, and you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Whatever. Most people, even if they don't like it or don't, but they
people
just
ain't getting it.
Just
hey, Tom.
My job.
All right. I'm going to put you on hold, Tom. If you can explain to people, I would appreciate it telling them that they got to listen. Oh, you know, I wonder. All right. I will ask Brendan from Northville. Brendan, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Peter, how are you?
Hey, Brendan, are you hearing the show on hold when you're on the phone?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, then people should be listening on the phone if you're on hold. All right, go ahead. You're on the air.
You know, honestly, first of all, I really want to say I love this country. There really is no other better country on earth. But I think the thing that's really got me worked up is the fact that people are just so politically biased. They don't really listen to what is either A, being debated, or B, what the subject is about before they make up their mind. But, you know, they look at where the Republicans stand or where the Democrats stand, and they go, well, you know, I vote a Republican, so I'm going to stick with George Bush. And I'm going to stick with him through thick and thin. I mean, Bill Clinton got impeached for lying. As far as I'm concerned, Bush lied to us worse than Clinton ever could have dreamed about. And,
well, sure.
And people eat it up.
Well, I don't know. People don't eat it up anymore at all.
To a certain extent, yeah, but I think there are still a lot of people that are conservative to the effect of, you know what, George Bush is the greatest president that ever lived, blah, 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 blah. And it's really kind of sad. They don't listen to
a third
what
of the,
is being...
A third of the German people loved Hitler.
Yeah, exactly. And look where that... And look at Stalin. People love Stalin.
Yeah, they did. So people love dictators.
More of his own countrymen than... And I'm not trying to be racist by any means, than Hitler did Jews. I mean, Stalin wasn't that bad of a guy until we got into the Cold War. So look where America has gotten us. To the point of... You know, the rich keep getting richer and the poor keep getting poorer.
Well,
and I know that's a horrible cliche, but...
Well, and unfortunately it's true and it's accelerating. But well, let me ask you a question, Brendan. You said, and I had your exact words in my mind, but you said something about this was the best country or the greatest country in the world or something like that. Is that right? Am I quoting you right? Or
to a certain extent, yeah. I'll give you that.
Well, you know, that in terms of overall statistics, that's nowhere near the case. I mean, for one thing, if you or I lived, you live in Northville, so if you were like 18 miles south of here and lived in Ontario, do you think your life would be worse or better? Or kind of the same? In other words, it's kind of weird to say that we're the best country in the world. So what does that mean? That Canada's number two or that, Sweden's number three or something like that?
No, I understand what you're saying. I do. But I think, you know, to a certain extent, Americans have just been brought up, especially, you know, since, and I'm a relatively young caller, I'm 24, Americans have been brought up to believe that, again, America is the greatest country. And, you know, and like I said, I love my country. God help the country that tries to invade us, because I will be one of the first people on wherever they go giving up my life for this country.
Sure. Well, I think that's probably true with all of us. But just, and I'm sorry, I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but I have the advantage. I'm looking at this article. It's called Number One, America by the Numbers, Michael Ventura. The United States is 49th in world literacy. I mean, these are staggering statistics. The United States is 28th out of 40 countries in mathematical literacy. In other words, we're down in the bottom 25%. And it just goes on and on and on like this.
Oh, yeah.
You know what infant mortality is? The percentage of children that die in the first year.
Yeah.
What would you guess that the United States would be? It's not number one. I'll give you a clue.
No, that's fine. To be truthful, the way the media builds it up, we would be number one. I mean, with what you just said to me, I probably believe, like you said, we're probably in the lower 25%.
Well, actually, we're not in this, but we're 41st. In other words, there's 40 countries more. So where does this all come from? Women are 70% more likely to die in childbirth in America than in...
And that's it. I mean, there are people out there that can't go to the hospital because they can't afford it, and yet at the same time, you know, we're supposed to have this amazing pharmaceutical cure everything, just take a pill and everything's okay. And yet, like you said, we're 41st in child mortality rate, and women are dying on our...
Let's see here.
Doctors hundreds of thousands of dollars a year to supposedly help us get better, and it really doesn't work.
Right here, the World Health Organization ranked the countries of the world in terms of overall health performance, and the U.S. was 37th. In fairness of health care and in terms of availability, 54th. So, you know, it's interesting, though, Brendan, because when you say things like that, this is probably irritating some people. They're saying, why is he criticizing our team, our mother, our religion? You know what I'm saying? People don't like to hear criticisms of the country. But we have to get rid of these myths and understand and ask ourselves, if we are the wealthiest country in the world, why are we 49th in literacy? Why do we have some of the worst? We have the worst health care of any industrialized nation in terms of its availability to everybody, and on and on and on like that. Because if we don't recognize the problems and we don't understand, as you said, that it's all rooted in the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer, we're just going to continue like this.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
All right. Thank you, sir. I appreciate it. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. And here is, we're going to try Tom again in Westland. Tom, hi. It's Peter Werby.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing great.
Good. I have several things I'd love to comment on, but I'm afraid I probably don't have enough time. But a couple of things I'd like to address. I'm sure you got a lot of listeners here, and I'd like to address the whole, you know, whoever's listening. I'd like to ask him a question. I mean, if the government is responsible for 9/11, you know, would our country really like to know about it? I mean, how much fear would that put into the hearts of Americans to know that our government is responsible for so many deaths?
Do you think that that's the case?
I really do.
Okay.
I've seen a lot of research on it and a lot of books and movies, and like Fahrenheit 9/11, I mean, they addressed the fact that, I mean, so many facts that a plane couldn't have done the demolition that the buildings went down in, and, you know, the Pentagon, the hole was way too big for the size of a plane to go, or too small for the size of a plane to go into. There's just so many things that just kind of contradict the whole fact that the media has been telling the whole public of.
Well, I think it's very, very interesting that I don't know what the figures are, 25 or 30% of, you know, these polls I've seen, Americans do not believe the official explanation. And here in something where we suffered a catastrophic attack on September 11th, that there are tens of millions of Americans that think either George Bush and the Republicans were directly behind it, or the fact that you know, there's something that's way amiss. All right, well, thank you for that. I appreciate it. And what did I – oh, yeah. This is Pete to Pete. Pete writes in to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. He says, I drive a diesel pickup, and in the spring I found that a local gas station started selling biodiesel. I've been running it since, and you would not believe how clean it burns. It's a bio blend, so it's 20% bio and 80% diesel. Right now it's only 5% cheaper, but it's better for the environment, so I use it. I wish it was at all gas stations. Well, I know. It can actually run on all biofuel, right? Or get it down to 50 or 50. Get rid of that oil. We got to get rid of our dependence on oil. I mean, that is extraordinarily important. All right. Marshall's listening in Yonkers and gave me a link. I was just going to say kind of a shout-out to people listening far away and the rest of you listening on the Internet. But have you talked about this article tonight? I'm going to have to paste it in and look at it in a little while. I don't know if we have time for that, but let's go back to our phones in our final moments. I'm going to have to get through some of these kind of quickly. Nick in Washington Township. Nick, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
Going great.
Good. Yeah, it's kind of sort of general here, but I remember a few calls ago, but you were saying, why don't more people question what's going on with the government in the world and pretty much everything like your station does? Why aren't there more stations? Why aren't there more media outlets that, you know, use reason rather than just take on a certain belief or
sure
along those lines? Why don't you, do you have an ex, can you think of a reason why that might be?
Well, they all are corporate owned, and there's corporate interest that dominate. These people are sort of have this interlocking racket. I'll tell you, I think if there was a free debate, that if you'd let everybody from the left and the right and the center equally discuss things, that this world would look a lot different. Because right now, it's the sound of one hand clapping. It's the right hand. And in spite of that, people now have a lot of access, as someone said just a little while ago, to the Internet, where we can find a lot of diverse opinions. But, like, for instance, if you go to my website and you go to this stuff about Israel, let me see if I can do it real. Oh, yeah, it says right on the front page. It says there's another side to the story besides the unquestioning one being reported in the pro-Israeli mainstream corporate-owned and driven media. And I just say, make sure you know the other side, because how are we supposed to, I mean, in a democratic society, we're supposed to know both sides, and then we figure out which fits our view of the world, our ethics, and all of that. When you get one side, well, you wind up with the answer that the people communicating want you to have. Because you got to remember, every media is a medium, right, between reality and you. So everybody that's broadcasting, including yours truly, is trying to get you to think in a particular way. Now, but what I hope you do with me is that I make you think, I give you information that you might not have, and information that you, if it sounds questionable, you should check, and then look at the other side. You not won't get anybody in the mainstream media saying that. You turn on ABC News, and it looks like the Oracle. Everything from, you know, the setting, the stage setting, to the fact that they have people everywhere. They talk to the president. They talk to the generals. And in comparison, who the hell am I? You know, talking, you know, yakking in the, you know, almost in the middle of the night. So the other side of it gets reduced to almost nothing. So well, I don't know if that answers your question at all.
I think, you know, maybe, you know, as far as the corporations running and owning, you know, they have their intentions and special interests, you know, to display certain biased information, you know, based on what serves their purpose. But I think it runs a little deeper, like, as far as the way schools are designed and the way, you know, children, it starts with the kids, basically, how they're raised in their families. I don't think today's youth is being raised to actually become an individual. They're raised, you know, to accept a certain religion because it's in their culture, or become a certain party member, or believe in, they basically just accept something just because they're familiar with it. And I don't think schools and our educational system, you know, they don't help us become individuals. They want us to just, you know, join into a group, and it seems like we're creating a society where people are afraid to have their own beliefs because they'll become, sure, considered an outcast, or even worse, nowadays it seems like some people are afraid to have a certain belief because they're afraid they'll be considered a terrorist. It's just, we're breeding a culture where now, you know, we're just going to be a bunch of zombies walking around. There's no one going to be with their original thoughts, with something that they can't decide anything for themselves. It's just going to be, you know, people, I think when people gather in numbers, they become stupid. I think the individual is far more intelligent than a large group. Because I think when a bunch of people come together, you know, they start, I think it just gets a little chaotic, and this is the problem, you know.
Well, you can have individuals that think similarly. I mean, there is a problem with crowd thinking, but the worst thing, it's not just, I mean, people coming together in a union hall or in a community center or in a church or something like that to discuss issues, even when they're all like thinking, is a lot different than what I call the spectacle, which is what we see on television. You have a few active communicators, and I'm talking about my industry, and I'm talking about me, and people ought to be, they ought to have a suspicion about me, and they ought to have even a greater suspicion about the people. All right, let me say this. Be suspicious of everybody on radio and television, and do the kind of critical thinking. But what media expects you to do is be this passive receptor of the information that you're given. So you have active communicators, masses, as you're correctly saying, of these passive receptors, and that are isolated and fragmented and atomized. I mean, at some point that we have to get together, Nick, because if we don't, then we are individuals, a single person who may have an independent thought in their mind, but can do nothing against entrenched power. With that all said, I have to say goodnight because I have to get these commercials in before 1 a.m. Thank you, sir.
Yep.
I appreciate it. Keep on critically thinking, and my apologies to those of you left on the line. We got to go. 1 a.m., which is in about 6 minutes, the fighting is supposed to stop in Lebanon. Let's hope it does. We'll talk next week. Stay tuned for the interviews.
Hear the best rock the Motor City has to offer before they hit it big. Motor City Riff. Every Sunday night at 10. It's loud. It's local. And no friggin' satellite can give you the best local band. Like the station that supports local rock. 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks. Rock, rock, rocks.
This is WRIF.com.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. A pleasure to be with you. We see the results of war now every day on our television, whether it's Iraq, whether it is in Lebanon, whether it is anywhere in the world. And we see the results. We see the results on the cities. We see the results on the people that inhabit them, the terrible wounds, the look of fear. But when the war is over, most of us figure that's the time when the healing begins, the war is over, and rebuilding begins. But there's a toll that continues on, and it's the subject of a book by Penny Coleman. The book is called Flashback, Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder, Suicide, and the Lessons of War. And Peggy Coleman is a scholar and documentary photographer. She was married to a Vietnam veteran who committed suicide, so she has a direct interest and stake in all of this. She's in upstate New York, and we're talking to her now on the Peter Werby Show. Penny Coleman, welcome to the broadcast.
Thanks, Peter.
Is it this personal tragedy in your life that propelled you into writing?
It certainly was the motivating, it was the motivating incident. It was, it took me a very long time to get there, though. And Daniel came back in 1969, and I met him 6 months later, and we spent five traumatic years together. He was an absolutely beautiful, wonderful, gentle man, great storyteller, somebody who could keep people laughing for hours. But he was about Vietnam. And when I interviewed other women for Flashback, I heard the same story over and over again. Vietnam was really off limits. I think they thought they were protecting us, but really I think they were protecting themselves. What we didn't know, we weren't going to judge. We could be sanctuaries, safe places where they could pretend that Vietnam had never happened. But then we couldn't even try and understand. So the trade-off was intimacy. I knew he was sad. I knew he was in pain. But he never let me in.
And he took his own life.
He threatened to several times before I left. And I would talk him out of it. I thought it was very romantic to be loved that desperately. I was in my early 20s. The last time he didn't give me a chance, and I found him by a freak accident and got him to the hospital, and he wasn't grateful at all. He was furious, and he said he was going to do it again as soon as he got out, and that felt like extortion. I was a kid. I had no idea how to save him, so I saved myself. I left, and then his sister called me and told me that he'd been successful.
Now, of course, a tragedy on so many levels, but and you probably thought you were being uniquely visited by it, but
I did. I mean, PTSD wasn't an official diagnosis until 1980, and I think I and most of the women who I interviewed for the book really thought that we had personally failed, that we hadn't loved enough or noticed enough or intervened quickly enough.
Or you shouldn't have left.
I shouldn't have left.
No, I mean, there's always the guilt factor.
Sure, yeah. And a lot of the other women that I spoke to did the same thing. It just got too bad. And in Daniel's case, as in many of the other vets, husbands of, or sons or fathers of the women that I spoke to, he was over-medicating, self-medicating. And that was very hard to live with. But when I started talking to these other women, I got really angry. We were all still blaming ourselves. We all thought we were responsible, and I think this book was an attempt to push back against that.
Penny Coleman, put this all in a time frame. That's just a little vague here in terms of Daniel's suicide and when you began writing the book and when you talked to these women.
I didn't start to think of myself as a war widow until the late 80s. And even then, it took me a really long time to come to terms with the fact that it was the war that had killed him.
And when did he take his life?
In the really early 80s.
Okay. Yeah.
1981.
All right. The book is Flashback, Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder, Suicide, and the Lessons of War. The Vietnam War is thought of, at least by most people, as the only war that the United States ever lost. And so a lot is attributed to the travail that the veterans suffered on lots of levels to that fact. Of course, we haven't finished with Iraq yet. But Is this similar to other war or different than other wars? Did the when Johnny came marching home triumphantly? I mean, there was always the term shell shocked.
Yeah, there was. That was the at the beginning of the First World War. There, it's been known by lots of different names, and most of them have implied that there was something wrong with the soldier. In World War II, it was neurasthenia, which translated into weak nerves or hysteria, which is derived from the Greek word for womb, which associates combat-induced breakdown with hormonally compromised women and not unsubtly insinuates that a soldier with that kind of an injury might not be quite a man. And that prejudice is still very much a part of military culture. But since 1980, there has been an official diagnosis in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual that, you know, describes the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, and that has changed over time. But it's essentially in the manual now. And in 1990, the government funded a National Vietnam Veterans Readjustment Study mm-hmm. that used those criteria to quantify and expose the extent of damage that war inflicts on soldiers. The NVVRS found a lifetime prevalence of 30.9%.
Wow, that's PTSD. Almost a third.
Yeah. Yes.
Now, that's across the board, so whether you win in World War II or stalemate in the Korean War... So
those were Vietnam veteran theater. Vietnam theater.
Well, I was asking you whether you had any data.
Well, I was going there, actually, next.
Go ahead. Sorry.
They took those criteria then and went back to Korean War veterans and discovered that 60 years after their service, those surviving still, 30% of them were suffering from post-traumatic stress.
Mm-hmm.
And just recently, the Journal of the American Medical Association came out with a study that estimates that 1 in 3 Iraq War veterans are going to come home with post-traumatic stress disorder. So there are 3 very different wars, but the same 30% who have experienced, or in the case of Iraq, will experience clinically serious stress reaction symptoms.
In your book, Flashback, Penny Coleman, you mentioned the fact that perhaps more men have died as a result of their own hand, Vietnam veterans, than actually died in the war.
I have gotten in a lot of trouble for that. I did not make it up to begin with. It's quoted in very conservative sources like the Oxford Companion to American Military History and media sources as mainstream as 60 Minutes and Discover Magazine, CBS News have also repeated those numbers. But it's never stopped being a hot button issue, and the government gets very upset when anybody suggests that anybody repeats it. But that NVVRS study that I was just speaking about, which was provoked and preceded by any number of studies to which suicide was central, never mentioned suicide. So, you know, what is that about? Is it just an oversight? I mean, I don't think so. It's been 30 years since American troops withdrew from Vietnam, and they still haven't done a study that would finally determine what the relationship is between combat PTSD and suicide. They don't do the investigation, and then they say there's no proof. So I have entirely credible sources who support my claim, but I admit I don't have the scientific evidence. Neither do they. I really want them to do those studies. They're the ones with access to the money and the service records. And I can't come up with a more logical explanation for the decades of denial than that it's a cynical strategy to avoid taking responsibility for a population that's emotionally incapable of protecting itself.
Mm-hmm. Now, is there, in your estimation, something unique about the veterans of the Vietnam War? They seem to garner somewhat less respect. Certainly there's monuments and all sorts of other appreciation of their sacrifice. On the other hand, there is sort of a countervailing mythology that they were losers, they were anti-war, that they were...
Oh, I think that was Nixon's evil genius. I really do.
How's that?
He really needed the support of the veterans. And to do that, he needed to drive a wedge between good veterans, you know, the guys who ironed their uniforms for parades and kept their hair short and supported the war and voted Republican, and bad veterans who grew their hair and smoked pot and threw their medals away mm-hmm. and marched against the war. So his twist was to blame the PTSD that veterans came home from the war with on the peace activists. And he suggested that it was peace activists who blamed the veterans and refused to welcome them home and were therefore responsible for their psychic injuries. And that same distorted version of history was dredged up again in the 90s by Bush the Elder, who used it to rally support for the first Gulf War. He's the one who made supporting the troops synonymous with supporting the war. And this Bush has recycled that same faux logic one more time for his war. And it's really amazing how blinding that rhetoric manages to be.
Do you think there's anything at all in the suggestion? I mean, a population should not blindly support war policies that are wrong, and we see now the majority of people of the United States oppose the Bush war policy in Iraq. And but when soldiers don't feel the support of the country that they're risking their lives for, when the government doesn't support them, we always say it was the government that spit on the Vietnam veterans, not the anti-war movement. The anti-war movement, in fact, as you say in your book Flashback, was very supportive of veterans and of active duty GIs. But I guess I'm kind of reiterating a question as you've already answered.
Yeah, I think where I think you're going is betrayal.
Yeah.
Yes?
Yeah.
The man who wrote the foreword for Flashback, Jonathan Shea, wrote two brilliant books about homecoming for Vietnam veterans, Achilles in Vietnam and Odysseus in America. And one of his central theses is that what's right, or a moral grievance, when that's added to combat stress, it's the combination that causes lasting psychological injury. And, you know, obviously in Vietnam, the list of betrayals was endless. It's not that different from a list that you might come up with for the soldiers in Iraq. But the most central betrayal of all, that all of them, the veterans, the soldiers and veterans of both of those wars have lived with, is an utter contempt for life. And not just the lives of Vietnamese or Iraqis, but the lives of American soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
In Vietnam, Agent Orange was not an unfortunate accident, as depleted uranium now isn't. In Vietnam, more than 17 million gallons of dioxin-based chemicals were sprayed over South Vietnam, and they were our allies, at 25 times the recommended dilution. It wasn't just a defoliant. It was specifically intended to poison food and water supplies. Documents uncovered in the National Archives in the late 80s confirmed that by 1967, at the very latest, military officials knew what the health risks of dioxin exposure were, and there was no attempt whatsoever to protect or forewarn either U.S. troops or Vietnamese citizens. So aside from using it to poison 6 million acres of countryside, these soldiers were encouraged to use it to clear their base perimeters. They used the empty drums to store food, and they rigged them for showers.
Hmm.
So they're sleeping with this stuff. They drank it in their water. They ate it in their food. They breathed it when it dropped out of the air. And then for the next 20 years, the government released one cravenly falsified study after another to deny them support. By 2001, there were 325,000 Vietnam vets listed in the Agent Orange Health Registry.
Wow.
Those who weren't already dead were suffering from cancers and neurological diseases, and their kids were being born with horrific birth defects. And now in Iraq, the depleted uranium that the U.S. is using in its armaments, the U.N. Commission on Human Rights has called it a weapon of mass destruction, and its use a breach of international law. And it's causing the same illnesses and cancers and deaths among our own troops as among Iraqi citizens. And they just don't seem to care.
And the Vietnamese are still suffering birth defects to this day, aren't they?
Absolutely. Well, so are Americans.
Is that right? That even continues in our genetic structure?
Absolutely.
The book is Flashback, Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder, Suicide, and the Lessons of War. My guest is Penny Coleman. You're listening to the Peter Werby Show. Let's go back a little, because you cover this in your book about the way soldiers in Vietnam reacted to the war itself. Many people have said that, in fact, the resistance to the war among active duty GIs was as high as the population, and since they were in the same age group, their attitudes were very similar, as opposed to seeing one another as enemies.
Absolutely. I mean, before I started this book, I would have said that, you know, that it was the fierce commitment of the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong, and the political pressure that those of us in the anti-war movement put on the government. But I was astonished to discover that just about I and just about everyone I know have no memory of the role played by the GI movement. And now I think that I want to give them at least as much credit, and maybe more. Before 1969, soldiers who opposed the war expressed their opposition through what was known as combat avoidance. They made up excuses to get out of missions or to be sent to the rear.
Mm-hmm.
But from 1969 on, that combat avoidance was increasingly replaced with outright mutiny. In August of 1969, there was a front-page banner headline in the New York Daily News which read, "Sir, my men refuse to go." An entire company had refused a direct order, which theoretically was punishable by death, to go down a road they thought was dangerous. That was the first incident of mass mutiny. But from 1969 on, those incidents multiplied. And desertion was a further indication that a quarter of all GIs went AWOL, some for weeks and some for years. In 1971, there were 100,000 soldiers that deserted. And then the fragging, which was using a fragmentation device, usually a hand grenade, to kill unpopular officers, was probably the most heartbreaking example of the level of chaos. There, somewhere between 20 and 25% of all the officers who died in Vietnam were killed by their own men.
Colonel Robert Heinle Jr., who was a military analyst for the Detroit News during the 1960s, wrote a famous study that you refer to in your book, Flashback, called The Collapse of the Armed Forces. And whereas Nixon said he would not be the first American president to preside over a losing war, Heinle reminded him he might lose the army.
He actually did lose the army. I mean, from 1971 on, in a lot of units in Vietnam, only the soldiers who were on guard duty or on patrol were allowed to carry their weapons. I mean, in the middle of the war, they took the soldiers' guns away. And when Nixon began to understand how absolutely unreliable his army was, he came up with Vietnamization, which was a face-saving strategy that would allow him to withdraw American ground forces and claim he was turning the war over to the Vietnamese, when really what he was doing was trying to shift the burden of the fighting to the Navy. But that only served to expand resistance in the Navy. So from 1970 to 1972, fires, engine sabotage, riots, mutinies, left the Navy every bit as useless as the Army. In 1972, there were 5 sabotaged aircraft carriers out of commission in San Diego Harbor.
They couldn't leave.
No,
yeah,
you're talking about millions of dollars worth of damage. And there was an open revolt on the USS Constellation that the New York Times reported and called the first mass mutiny in the history of the U.S. Navy. And by 72, the Air Force was in revolt, too. Airmen were distributing underground papers and protesting all over the country. But in 73, when Nixon continued to secretly bomb Cambodia after he'd signed the Paris Peace Accords,
mm-hmm.
airmen not only refused to fly bombing missions when they were court-martialed, they sued the Pentagon. They challenged the legality of the bombing itself, and their arguments were upheld all the way up to the Supreme Court, at which point the government dropped the charges. I don't think Nixon had a choice but to withdraw.
Well, there's also one of the mythologies, I don't know how widespread it is what I call a Hitlerian mythology, that Hitler said that the German army did not lose World War I, but it was the stab in the back theory that in fact
the fifth column
that they had lost at home, that the weak-kneed politicians, sort of that the Rambo thing, they were ready to go, but the craven politicians are the ones that didn't allow a victory by the forces. And then it's the feminized effete, effect that disgraced Vice President Nixon. Agnew even used the phrase effete, sort of sexless.
He called anti-war demonstrators brown shirts. I mean, they were. I think that was Agnew, actually. But they were amazing, those two.
Let's do this, though. I just looked at the clock. We only have about 4.5 minutes. Your book, Flashback, it has a subtitle, Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder, Suicide and the Lessons of War. And it doesn't sound like the American state has learned those lessons. We've now had 1 million men and women fight in Iraq. And what signs are they showing? And is anything being done any differently for these people coming back?
Instead of gearing up to take care of these kids who are going to need help, the VA was handed over to another one of those breathtakingly inappropriate Bush appointees. This guy is a real estate developer. He was head of the Republican National Committee and ambassador to the Vatican with no health care experience and no shame when it comes to submitting ridiculously inadequate budgets. So last summer there were 50,000 veterans waiting to see a doctor for the first time. And you know, they're dying while they're waiting. And individual therapy is a thing of the past. PTSD groups have long waiting lists. The VA just admitted that in 2006 they budgeted for fewer PTSD cases for the whole year than they treated in the last 3 months of 2005. And that's just nonsense. I mean, I know a lot of well-meaning Americans believe that this war is legitimate and necessary and that they would disagree with me about a lot of things. But I hope we can all agree that if we send soldiers to fight in our name, we should take care of them when they come home. And that's not happening now.
Well, I noticed in the so-called Battle for Baghdad, I've read some accounts of when they are, quote, clearing a neighborhood. And I read this one account where they burst into this home, they heard people behind this door, shot into this room through the door, and then threw a grenade in there, opened the door, and there was this family of elderly and women and children. What does that do to the young man or woman who sees that?
They're never, ever going to get over that. And, you know, these kids have been sent back in 2 and 3 times, and they know that that's not safe. They've exhausted the psychic resources of these kids, and it seems that, you know, almost every day now there's a new report of a rape or a murder or some atrocity committed by American soldiers. And it is predictable, it's inevitable that they would be out of control. And it's not, you know, it's happened before. And I have no doubt that it's going to continue to happen as long as the architects, you know, the policymakers get away with declaring themselves judgment-proof.
Hmm. Well, I'm sure, given the breadth of listenership to the station, that we have a 22-year-old veteran of Iraq and a 62-year-old veteran of Vietnam listening. And maybe everything you're saying to them just strikes home. And any suggestion, where did they go? Where would they turn if they're still haunted by, PTSD or other emotional difficulties from war?
I think that where I would go, given what I've, the people that I've been talking to and my own experience, is to the vet centers. For me, talking to other women about who had lived through similar situations was very healing. And I think that from what I understand happens in the veterans rap groups, they're allowed to practice forgiving other people who lived through the same kind of horror that they've lived through, and that really, really helps them. I think we need each other to heal.
Well, thank you so much.
The vet centers.
Thank you so much for being with us. The book is Flashback, Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder, Suicide, and the Lessons of War. It's published by Beacon. I don't think I said that yet. And you can go to their website, which is beacon.org. Is there a specific Flashback website?
There isn't.
Okay. So, yeah. Well, you can go. Okay. I should have asked this before. Beacon.org is where to go. Just finally, from Dr. Robert J. Lifton, author of Home from the War, Learning from Vietnam Veterans. He says, flashback is a remarkable combination of painful experience and thoughtful interpretation, and we need to learn from this. Penny Coleman, thanks so much for being with me on the Peter Werbe Show.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. I wonder how many of you remember the movie Cabaret. It was on stage. In fact, it had a revival only a few years ago. Well, they had a song in there called Money Makes the World Go Round. One I particularly like. Joel Grey did it in the movie. And the movement of money we think about, we work, we get paid, we go to the store. That's it. High finance, I think most of us know, is a pretty shadowy world that the average person has an enormous inability, if I'm any example, to track, to figure out how do these billions and sometimes trillions of dollars make the world go around? Who's controlling it? And is it all on the up and up? Well, I came across a brand new released novel, and this is going to surprise you. This came out of a novel, but the theme of it is Swiss banking, how it figures in the world economy. The book is called Trust, a novel. It's written by Charles Epping, and Charles Epping is a Swiss-based banker and financial writer. He's the author of A Beginner's Guide to the World Economy. That's what I need. And Trust is a brand new novel published by Greenleaf Book Group Press, and it looks at the fraudulent use of a lost Swiss trustee account by the Hezbollah to launder money. Although I'm reading this, and I don't know that. Well, we'll get into this. Anyways, Charles Epping is joining us from Geneva, Switzerland, right now. Welcome to the broadcast. That's actually not really what it's about. It's not about Hezbollah laundering money, is it?
Well, it is, Peter. As you mentioned, you know, Trust is a novel about a trustee account that was opened actually by a Jewish family from Budapest in just before World War II. It's interesting you opened the segment by mentioning the film Cabaret, because the reason I got to know this world so well is that I work as a consultant here in Switzerland, and I was doing a project for a family from Budapest. And one of the uncles actually was the base of the famous baron. Remember the rich baron who had all of the houses and the cars and was the wealthy element in the Berlin of the 1930s. That was based on one of the family members of the family I worked for.
Hmm. Well.
So what I did is I actually used them as a sort of source to do a what if story. I did because I have, as you mentioned, worked in Swiss banking for so long that I thought it would be interesting to sort of look at how one of these trustee accounts would have ended up today if the trustee were honest and kept it growing, very different from the normal dormant accounts that everybody's heard about that the Swiss banks kind of kept and didn't let anybody have access to. These trustee accounts, since they were opened outside of the bank through a trustee, all depended on whether the trustee were honest or dishonest. So I kind of did a what-if story. What if the trustee actually were honest and kept the money growing? Did a little study. I don't know how many of your listeners are aware of this, but it's an amazing little statistic. If you had put $10,000 in the Standard & Poor's 500 index in 1938, which is when this family opened the account in Trust, today it would be worth 1,000 times what you put in. So $10,000, if it's just kept in there, reinvesting the dividends, of course, would today be worth $10 million.
And the family that in the novel, Trust, put in considerably more than that, so we wind up with an account worth, what is, $400 million.
Yeah, it's pretty extraordinary. And even then, I didn't really use the whole 1,000. I assumed that maybe the trustee weren't quite so good. But even then, you know, it's amazing how much money. I think it was Albert Einstein who said compounded interest rates are truly the eighth wonder of the world. So when you just keep adding money to money, it's amazing what it can become today. So the what if question took me to the point of saying, well, what if the trustee now dies and all this money is just sitting there? Could it be used for money laundering? And I chose an obscure Middle East terrorist group. Obviously, the book was written over the last several years. And I chose the Hezbollah. And I chose them for a reason, because I didn't want a cliche. I didn't want, you know, drug dealers or, you know, a third world dictator. But on the other hand, I wanted a group that was very active in the international financial system. And actually, I don't know, you know, how many of your listeners know this, but Detroit is one of the centers that the Hezbollah operatives use for some of their smuggling operations. One of the recent ones was cigarettes.
Yeah, and actually there was a prominent Lebanese restaurateur that was just indicted for diverting $23 million in funds to Hezbollah.
That was in March, I think, of this year.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. And he's left to Lebanon to be safe.
Yeah. Well, I think they ended up actually indicting a total of 19 people. And that's just one example of how the Hezbollah, it's very eerie almost, Peter. The Hezbollah is using borders to its advantage. Now, we're seeing it in the news, how they're using the Lebanon-Israeli border to kind of protect themselves. They go across, they attack, they send rockets, and then they slip back behind borders. It's amazing how they've kind of developed this technique in the financial world as well, because it's not only using the discrepancies between cigarette taxes between Michigan, say, and North Carolina, where a lot of the cigarettes come from, where there are no taxes or very low taxes. They're doing the same thing all over the world. There's a huge area in Brazil, in the novel, which I actually did a lot of research for Trust, and I did research into the area that the Hezbollah has been active in, which is the triple border region between Argentina, Brazil, and Paraguay. They're using that area in the same way that they've used the border between Michigan and other states in the same way they're using the border between Israel and Lebanon.
Now, Charles Epping, we're going to have to talk a little after this interview, because I read this novel cover to cover, and the Hezbollah part, don't correct me, because we got to talk about other things, but I remember that, you know, you're talking about the South America region and all of that, but so you're going to, you'll refresh my memory after our conversation.
Sure, yeah,
on
that's the great thing about a novel that has so much in it.
It's fast-paced. That's the other thing. It's breathless. And, you know, I didn't want to make the analogy to the Da Vinci Code.
Da Vinci Code,
but
yeah.
Since,
a lot of people are. Fortunately, that's a good thing.
Well, your ad in Publishers Weekly also is feeling a bit Da Vinci'd out, so then I didn't feel so badly.
Right.
And, I mean, this has, you know, Hollywood film all over it. I mean,
yeah, it's funny. You know, a lot of people have said that. In fact, there's a woman in Southern California who makes trailers just like they make for movies. She made a trailer for Trust, the novel. In fact, if any of your viewers want to see it, we put it on the website, which is called trustthenovel.com. And on their front page is a big button saying play the book trailer. So, you know, it's got the fast-paced music and, you know, it flashes. It's about 65 seconds. It's really fun. Tell your listeners to crank up the sound.
Okay.
But the idea is that they get an idea of sort of the pace of the novel, which is, as you said, it's very similar to a movie.
Yeah, sometimes the details do slip as you're wondering whether or not the heroine is going to escape the clutches of the evildoer. So it's trustthenovel.com. I'll have it on my website as well, a link at peterwerby.com. Let's get a little, Charles Epping, into the structure of your novel, Trust. You mentioned Nazis, Jewish families, secret banking accounts, but flesh that out a little. What was happening in 1938, and why would Jews have been taking their money to Switzerland?
Well, yeah, it's actually a fascinating story. In fact, I appeared at Borders just recently in Farmington Hills, and there were several people in the audience who actually had lived through that time. There actually was a Holocaust survivor whose family had money in Switzerland, and she was asking me to help her find out what happened to it. It was an amazing encounter. We sat there well beyond the allotted time at the bookstore. Amazing people up there. And what I did is I kind of explained how in 1938, when the Nazis had already started invading countries, they'd invaded Austria just in the spring. One of the first things they did is they went to the banks and they made the banks give them all of their accounts that had Jewish owners. There were a lot of families who had accounts in Switzerland. Obviously, nobody knew what was going to happen later, but there was this fear that if the Nazis ever invaded Switzerland, the same thing would happen in Zurich and Basel and Geneva that happened in Vienna. So what many families did, and nobody really knows how many, but there certainly were a large percentage of families who took their money and put it in the hands of a trustee, had the trustee go into the bank, which was perfectly legal. In fact, it was legal in Switzerland all the way up until the 90s to have these trustee accounts. So the question is, you know, they did certainly, these accounts survived the war. These trustee accounts never appeared on the lists of dormant accounts that everybody heard about in the 90s and the first part of this decade. So the question is, if the trustee were honest, How much money could still be around just waiting for someone to come and claim it?
So the idea that there's this huge fortune and how it's being used is the basis of Trust, the novel that you've written. The heroine, if you will, the central person, sure. Alex Payton, both has has an androgynous name, and it in many ways a very masculine character in terms of her assertiveness, and frequently some of the male figures just call him Rudy without explaining.
Her partner in crime.
Yeah, he's nervous, he's scared.
Yeah.
How much of Charles Epping is in Alex Payton?
Well, there's obviously a bit of the author in every character, but it actually was based on a woman I know who is a computer consultant. And I think, you know, we're seeing it in movies as well, since we were talking about movies before. There is this whole sort of new wave of young women actresses, Uma Thurman, you know, Jodie Foster types, who are the active heroes. You know, the Sigourney Weaver in Alien, I think, was one of the groundbreaking roles of women coming into the scene and really taking charge. And I think that in the 21st century, I think we're going to see a lot more of that. I certainly, in business, you know, as we said, I've worked in Switzerland in banking and consulting for 20 years. We're seeing women taking a much more of a take charge role in business. So, you know, why wouldn't it happen in other areas of life as well? The idea that a woman is going after this actually ends up to her advantage. You remember she uses the fact that she's a woman to get into a couple places a guy probably never could have gotten into. So, and she uses her computer skills. That's the other thing that, you know, the original trustee who probably did try to find this family, couldn't have found them without the computer, access to the computer that people have today. So what I did is I sort of took an average American woman, and she's, you know, she's in Switzerland. She doesn't know all that much about what happened in World War II. She certainly doesn't know about money laundering. She doesn't really know how Swiss banks really work. She knows how their computers work. But what's interesting is that so the reader is going to learn about all this stuff through her eyes. So everything that Alex learns, the reader gets to learn, which I think makes for a pretty fun novel.
It does. It is.
She asks the obvious questions.
When I say it's breathless, I like that. It is, or what's the other kind of a cliche? Actually, breathless is kind of a cliche, but page turner.
Couldn't put it down.
A page turner.
Yeah. Right.
And my wife would say, are you coming to the table? You know, I'm saying, wait a minute. And
that's
then
the ultimate compliment, Peter. That's great.
And ultimately, too, it has that, which is a feature that I like in a lot of modern suspense novels. It takes place in a very short time in the characters get very, very, very little sleep.
Exactly. The clock is ticking because Alex finds out that what the account's been used for, and she knows that in a given amount of time, I think it was like 7 days, that the money launderers will find out that she knows. And the only way to keep them from finding out is to block access to the account. And the only way she can do that is to find a member of the family. So she goes on this, you know, this chase around the world, Budapest to Amsterdam to New York to Brazil, and it's, you know, the clock is ticking, and she really doesn't have time to sleep.
Now, Charles Epping, we're talking to you in Geneva, Switzerland, and probably the alert listener would say, wait a minute, he was right here in the area in Farmington Hills, and you're talking to him. Well, that's a long story, too, not worth the telling. But the time difference, we're recording this at 5 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, so you're at what,
11
p.m. So that figures in, too. There's all these little wrinkles. The time zone has a very critical little part to play towards the denouement, the end of the book as well.
Yeah, it's fun to really take all of these elements and throw them all together and try to, you know, do a what-if story and just try to put everything together, the Hezbollah, money laundering, Swiss bank accounts opened by Jewish families, trustee, bright young American woman. You know, those things really don't belong together, do they?
No. Well, Charles Epping, you said a key word there, fun. You've had about 8 other books. You've written 10 articles or so for Newsweek. There may be one coming out soon in the latest Newsweek about the whole money laundering
Hezbollah,
system in Hezbollah. And so one would not have picked, and these were nonfiction, the other one, and like the book, A Beginner's Guide to the World Economy, I'm very interested in that, but that doesn't sound like fun. Did you write this because, it's all of a sudden, actually, whoa, Charles took a right or left turn there.
I wrote that other book to have fun as well. You know, there were a couple of people at the Farmington Hills Borders that actually said, oh, I'd like to buy that, and it was there. So they went and bought it, and it's, you know, the idea of, that you can explain complex subjects like international finance, budget deficits, trade deficits, globalization, that you can explain it by using everyday examples. So I guess it really wasn't that, and certainly for me it wasn't that big of a leap to write a novel. The hardest part, of course, was just keeping everything together. That in a novel, because you do have the freedom to create, you have to remember every little detail that you've created. You know, if a character has blue eyes on page 20, they better have blue eyes on page 40. If they don't, you're in trouble, because I've always assumed my readers are smarter than I am.
Well, they are. There's always someone that will say, you know, he said, you're right. But still, I guess I, you know, it's not, I don't mean to be rude when I say I wasn't satisfied entirely with the turn from all nonfiction to fiction. What made you, because you could have written about these accounts and done, you know, you could have had photographs from, you know, Nazis marching into Vienna and all of right. that, but you decided, I'm going to write a novel.
Right, actually, you know, as I mentioned at the beginning of the story, this whole thing came about because I was working for a family from Budapest that doesn't actually live in Budapest anymore. They live in the United States and Canada and in Brazil. They had the rights to buildings in Berlin that the family had owned way back in the 20s. As I mentioned, one of the family members was one of the characters that Christopher Isherwood used in his books, The Berlin Stories, on which Cabaret was based. So I was spending years, actually, working for this family, going through the archives all over the world. Essentially, the German government was requiring them to have every document sealed, signed, sealed, and delivered before they would give them the buildings back. And that meant that even the members of the family who had died in the past, you still had to get their documents as well, which was an almost impossible task. But the family really wanted to do it more kind of as a moral gesture rather than just to get the money. So while I was doing that, I was hearing stories. You know, I was spending a lot of time, for example, in the Jewish center of Budapest. A couple of the women who work there are Holocaust survivors.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we got to be friends. And I would be sitting there, you know, day after day going through over these old books with handwritten entries trying to find, you know, great uncle Janosch's birth date. And these women would start telling me stories, and the stories, Peter, were amazing. I don't know if you've ever been to Berlin or to Budapest, but
no.
The Hungarians are great storytellers, and that was kind of what inspired me. I said, you know, the story, and these were, you know, a lot of it, all of it was, you know, were real stories. But I thought, you know, so many people have written those stories down in a way that, you know, it could be approached as nonfiction. Wouldn't that be a wonderful idea to take their stories and then bring them up to today and say, what if they were the ones who opened, what if this family was the one that opened this account, and that Alex today has to find a member of this family? So her quest really, for me, is almost, it's a great tool to use to take her back in time and to be confronting all of these stories that, as I said, she doesn't really know that much about. You know, a lot of people, young people, especially in the U.S., don't really know all that much about what happened in World War II, especially with, you know, old families like this one from Budapest. So, you know, I guess the idea of writing a novel, obviously everybody wants to say they've written a novel, but for me, I think it was Shakespeare who said the story is the thing. And if you can get great stories and put them together and make them hold together, you know, so much the better. You know, who was it who said, if you want to send a message, go to Western Union?
Charles Ebbing is my guest on the Peter Werby Show. The book is A Trust, a Novel, and you can go to the website for it, trustthenovel.com. And we're talking with Charles Ebbing in Geneva, Switzerland.
It's also available on Amazon. Very easy. You can just type in the word trust, and it comes up on top.
And so when your character in your novel, Trust, Alex Payton, goes to Budapest, in the descriptions of her looking through these records to try to find this family, this was not all imagination. This was something you'd actually experience.
You know, those are the best stories, is the ones that really are based on facts. And, you know, the feelings you have when you're sitting there in these offices and archives and down in the basements, and as I said, listening to those stories, it's pretty heartbreaking. And so, yeah, I wanted to keep those stories alive somehow. You don't want to let something like that just sort of disappear.
Well, when you were in Farmington Hills, Michigan, not so long ago, and talked about meeting some Jewish Americans, there are many Jewish Americans that have families that were exterminated by the Nazis in the late 1930s and 1940s. Mm-hmm. And for those that are listening, maybe the idea pops into their mind, maybe I have an account with $400 million in it. How prevalent are they still, or is there any way to know, since they're secret?
There's no way to know, but you know, when the dormant account scandal was happening, as I'm sure many of your listeners followed that...
You know, just give us maybe a little shorthand on...
Yeah, the dormant account was the U.S. government and several Jewish groups, both in the U.S. and elsewhere, really went after the Swiss banks and said, look, it's been 60 years. This was right in the late 90s. It's been 60 years since World War II. If you still have any dormant accounts, i.e. accounts that people opened in their own names and have just been sitting there in your banks because you didn't want to give them back to just anyone who walked in, the Swiss banks, as you know, are very, very formal. And unless people have all of their documents, they're not going to even admit that there is an account in the bank. And the banks had sort of been denying for years that there were many of them. They'd been saying there were a few, but not too many. So under all this pressure, the Swiss, mainly from the U.S. government, Stuart Eisenstadt did this project under the Clinton administration, Undersecretary of State, wonderful man. I went to see him, and he said, you know, that question also kept coming up. I was hearing it as well here in Switzerland. People kept saying, okay, fine, dormant accounts, the banks are coming clean. They actually, by the way, listed more than 20,000 accounts that they found under pressure.
But not with great fortunes in them, according to your book.
No, these were dormant accounts. These were the ones that the families had opened in their own names. The banks had just kept. They hadn't really invested them. They didn't provide any interest or minimal, and then they took fees. So the dormant accounts that people found and were given back really didn't have all that much money in them today. Obviously, you know, $10,000, $50,000 in World War II was a lot of money. But the question that kept coming up was, what about those trustee accounts? Which were legal. Everyone knew that they were opened. But the banks, of course, washed their hands of the whole story, saying, we were never told. That was the whole point. The families and the trustees didn't want the banks to know that the account holder really was a Jewish family, because they didn't want if the Nazis ever invaded Switzerland, they wanted to have that extra degree of security.
Well, let me just make sure that people understand. Like, Charles Epping, you're a Swiss-based banker. So it would be that a Jewish family would come and give you their money, their accounts, and you would be essentially the...
You have it all right, except it usually wasn't a banker. It was usually a lawyer, or a family friend, or a business person, or someone they knew maybe they could use as a trustee. And as I mentioned, that was legal in Switzerland all the way up until the 1990s.
Well, how did they had to trust the trustee?
They had, and which is the ironic part of the title. You know, I called my book Trust, because that's kind of what it's all about. It's
like,
how much trust do you have? I mean, how much can you trust someone to take your family's money and preserve it for you? You know, very similar to the Frank family in Amsterdam. The Anne Frank's father sold his store, his office, his assets to a Dutchman to hold and keep and preserve while the family went into hiding. And that obviously, you know, meant that he trusted this person to do the right thing.
I was going to ask you about your book, A Beginner's Guide to the World Economy. We're completely out of time, maybe another 60 seconds. This interview went by like your novel, Trust.
That's a good sign.
Breathless. But we never really got to the central question. Or is there any way to know? Is there zero trustee accounts, 10,000?
There definitely are accounts out there. Nobody knows, as I said, no one knows for sure how many there are. The key, though, is if you think you might have one, or your parents or grandparents might have opened one, you have to find the name of a trustee, someone that they would have trusted. Don't go to the banks, because the banks were never told.
So that's, it almost seems impossible. So could there be an account there for real, for like in your novel, like $400 million?
Absolutely. Yep.
Oh, Well, here is a wonderful compliment to your novel by Frank M. Robinson, author of The Towering Inferno. He says, readers looking for a thriller with the page-turning appeal of The Da Vinci Code need look no further. With this novel, Epping has become a major thriller writer. Quite a compliment.
It's great. That is great. And he's a great writer.
And well-deserved. And I'm looking forward, after having read the novel, to seeing it on the screen as well. Charles Epping, thanks for joining us from Geneva.
Thank you, Peter.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Radio Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are not transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
This is WRIF.com.
Jay Hudson.
Jay Hudson.
Jay Hudson, I love you.
Hello, Jay Hudson.
You're listening to Jay Hudson.
Jay Hudson.
What's up, Motor City?
I need to hear that, man.
One bad ass mother.
There is none higher.
Mr. Jay Hudson.
You're my boy!
Partying with Jay Hudson?
Oh, that sounds so sweet.
I'm calling the shots!
Oh,
this is a nightmare.
Yo!
You're rocking out with Jay Hudson.
Well, Lordy frickin' da!
101 WRIF Detroit. Everything that rocks.